welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. School Choice Week rages on in full swing, even as the actual choice that parents have is being taken away. And I look back to last night and our discussion with the mother of two from Philadelphia that they're closing the local school down, you know, the safe school that, you know, she chose to live in that neighborhood. Because of that school, well, they're going to send her kid to one of the most dangerous schools in Philadelphia. Choice? No, I think not. And understand, this whole choice thing, this is about destroying public education. It's about dividing and conquering the pot. It's about more privatization. And privatization nation is full underway here in Pennsylvania. The governor claims tomorrow he's going to roll out the big game plan on how they're going to attack the wine and spirit shops. Again, the liquor stores on the chopping block. Again. And, you know, I'm wondering what price tag he's going to put on it this time. What number did they pull out of the dark side of the moon are they going to use today? Because if you remember the whole beginning of this, and it's been a long saga, and, you know, we've been on this from the very beginning about the wine and spirit shop. Originally, it was $2 billion. Could have $2 billion. Very quickly moved away from the $2 billion number because everybody, and I think even they realized it was a BS number. Came down to 1.7, came down to 1 billion, came down to 750 million, then down to 500 million. And then you looked at it and you go, well, we bring in $500 million a year. We're going to give up this asset for 1 year. That doesn't make any sense. No, it's not about the money anymore. No, change. Pivot, turn, other direction. It's about core functions of government, they said. It's their ideology. And when you get down to the baseline in all of this, it's all about ideology with these people. Blind faith, ideology. Facts be damned, reality be damned, actual outcomes be damned. It's about ideology. It's our pure belief. Because these are people who live in the I believe world. And if it doesn't work, it's because we didn't do it far enough. It's like the free trade people who say, well, free trade, yeah, it's not working now. It's killing us. But we are not doing it enough. We need to do more. Same people who tell you, well, the economy is, during the Bush years, was faltering, one of the worst economic periods in the last 100 years. We gave out trillions of dollars in tax cuts, and it didn't work, and we said it wasn't going to work. But it's because we didn't go far enough. And we needed more, and we needed more, and we needed to feed the monster that much more. Because, again, blind faith ideology. We know it. We wrote it up on paper. It should work. And as I've always said, you know, I coached football for a couple of years. Every play I ever drew up, no matter how bad it was on the field, scored a touchdown. Same thing with their bizarre models. It just blows the mind. Also, austerity, still the GOP policy. It's a failure. I will tell you why. And the right talks of choice. Well, but limiting those choices at every turn, the latest attack on pensions here in Pennsylvania, just another in a long line of false choices. We'll go into that as well. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me during the show, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quinnipiac came out with a poll today, and, you know, it's one of those things where you go, someone paid you to do this? We already knew. This governor, Tom Corbett, not a very popular guy. Very high disapproval rating. In fact, 42% of the people disapprove, 36% approve. Fairly high for being just halfway through your first term. He has only once, this is what is really just amazing, only once has he hit the 50% approval line. That's pretty remarkable to me. His disapproval among women, extraordinarily high. You put that, you know, in the context, both Republican women and Democratic women, not thrilled. And you go, well, gee, I wonder why. Could it be that turn your head thing? You don't have, you know, while you're being invaded, you just turn your head. You don't have to watch, right? And what I loved about the Quinnipiac survey is they said there is no strong base of support for Governor Corbett among any income or age group or in any region of the state. In fact, they asked the question, does the governor deserve to be reelected? And Pennsylvania voters said 51 to 31, no. 54% to 24% among women, 48-38 among men. Only 49% of Republicans said he deserved a second term to be reelected. 49% of his faithful, of the base. And I guess, you know, a lot of it you have to look at and you go, well, what has he really done? He's given a lot of money away to big corporations. A lot. He's gone after, I think, just about everyone's project at some point or another. Whether it's programs to help seniors, whether it's education, whether it's healthcare funding, whether it's the social safety net, you name it. If there was something to be cut, they cut it. And, you know, Joe Scarnati did a press conference or like a little press briefing today where a couple of, you know, reporters came and sat and got to ask some questions. And he had some interesting thoughts. I'm not a huge fan of the senator, but, you know, at the end of the day, you know, he seemed more reasonable than the rest of the Republican Party. And I'm sure that's probably part of the reason that they put him out in front of this. And he said, look, you know, we've got some things that we got to work on. You know, the budget, transportation, the budget, you know, not this divisive stuff. We need a transportation bill. Absolutely. We've got some very serious things that need to be done. And he's talking about the pension, which I got to be honest, I'm not on board with them on the pension or their solutions. I think there's a lot of bad ideas being put forth and we need to talk about, and we will a little later in the program. But, you know, he seemed fairly reasonable. He said, you know, we need to get some money into safe schools and some education initiatives. Now, I'm kind of worried about what those education initiatives are. Are they more educational improvement tax credits where we're giving taxpayer dollars to private corporations for influencing our curriculum? Not so thrilled with that. And I don't know many people are. But when asked about, you know, the really divisive stuff like the no rights at work stuff, Michigan passed right to work. Well, when's Pennsylvania going to do it? He's, look, they've been doing that every year for the 12 years that he's been there. Something that's not there. But, you know, he was asked about, you know, about spending. And it's one of those things where you go, I've been saying for the longest time, we're down to the bone. We're cutting the bone off. If you listen to the main, many of the far right Republicans, they'll say, well, there's a waste, fraud, and abuse. And how many times have you heard that? Waste, fraud, and abuse. It's everywhere. Rampant. Government's rampant with waste, fraud, and abuse. Well, Scarnati was asked about that. And I definitely wanted to play that clip because, you know, it's one of those things that it catches my attention. And you go, well, got to give him credit. He's at least a little bit honest.
Are we done cutting right now?
Look. In the last 6 years, I don't think that I've sat at the budget table once where we haven't had to sit around line by line, whether it's been with the governor or with the budget secretary, cutting and finding those cuts. We initially cut through the fat, we cut through the muscle, and we are in bone. A lot of these programs, any further cuts, will have, I think, significant impacts to real people. Whether it's nursing homes, whether it's home health care, whether it's MHMR services, those with disabilities, that is a very, very difficult place to go any further. And I think that the administration recognizes that in just the fact that we're hearing them wanting to expand some spending there, increase spending. But I can't, unless there's some line or there's some program that I'm not aware of, we have gone about as far as you can with any compassion.
With any compassion. And I love the line, any further cuts, you know, it would impact real people. Like the last 2 years of cuts, the $2 billion from education, the 41,000 people that they booted off the adult basic plan, the 88,000 kids off the Medicaid, the 70,000 people off of the general assistance, you know, the most vulnerable and the most vulnerable, those weren't real people. I loved that. Any further cuts might impact real people. No, I would argue that we've been hurting real people for a couple of years now. It's just now that it's hurting people who vote. And as I pointed out, the governor's approval ratings, not very high, which is why I think you saw Scarnati come out today and have this press conference and start saying things like, you know what? We can't be tying stuff together. We can't be linking things to other bills. Because there's talk, and I've said this for a while. Understand, the pension thing, I do believe the deal is mostly done. And the trade-off was going to be we're going to hock off the wine and spirit shops so that we could say, well, you know, we're going to fill this, and because they're pitting group against group. So they'll sell off the wine and spirit shops, and they'll claim to fix the pension, but really they're going to divert that money somewhere else because it's what they do. Also talk of linking the wine and spirit shop to the transportation bill, which if you end up in a protracted fight, we'll then push the transportation bill off another 6 months, which might as well be another year because you're not going to get the money into the projects and get people back to work quick enough once you get it done. And I think he understands that. I don't think our governor does. I don't think Corbett gets it. And, you know, this statement that Scarnati thinks Corbett gets it, I don't. I don't think he gets the fact that his cuts have caused serious, serious pain and irreparable pain for a good number of people in this state. I just don't. I don't think that he gets it. And, you know, you look at, you know, on the pension front, one of the things Scarnati said in his press conference, and it's something that I've said, you know, the market caused this pension crisis, a big portion of it. The other part is you know, the change, the legislature said, hey, we're going to take a huge pension increase, and, hey, we're not going to fund it, and we're not going to pay over 10 years. That's part of it. The bigger part is the crash. Yet I don't hear him or any Republican who understand a lot of our problems, the vast majority, come from the numerous economic collapses where Wall Street has basically robbed and pillaged. Without any cop on the street, without anybody paying attention, they've basically taken for themselves at the expense of the rest of us. Yet I don't hear them saying, we should be regulating that. All I hear is, I heard him talk about, we want to have people with armed people in school districts if we can. Wow. It is an amazing thing. And he did throw out the canard about $41 billion pension thing. Did throw that out, even though I'm sure he knows that is a BS number. But it's a big number, and it catches people's attention. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the pension situation with somebody who actually may affect, you know, a teacher, you know, somebody. Quick break, right back after this. We want the world.
The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Nissan workers struggling to form a union at the automaker's Canton, Mississippi plant got support Tuesday from civil rights leaders, actor Danny Glover, as well as student and community activists. The workers want Nissan to be neutral and allow workers a fair election to decide whether or not to be represented by the United Auto Workers. Derek Johnson, president of Mississippi's NAACP, supports a union for these Nissan workers.
When workers go to work on Monday, they don't know whether that they're going to work a four-hour day or 12-hour day. They have no idea whether it's going to be a 4-day week or a 7-day week. They are pretty much held captive until the plant decides they can come and go.
Johnson says labor's struggle is a civil rights struggle for justice, and this Mississippi Nissan Workers Union organizing effort has national implications.
We see this as a civil rights issue. We see this as a national movement. We understand that what happens in the South as it relates to organized labor could make the difference of whether or not organized labor exists in this country, because it is the new battleground. Where the Midwest and the Northeastern states had a long, hard fight to organize, and as a result of that, you had individuals across racial lines, across gender, who were able to move up into the middle class. But in the South, where we have right-to-work states, where we have low union density, we see this as our opportunity to raise up the South, create a new paradigm, and allow workers to truly appreciate the benefit of their labor and increase the quality of their life.
A new Center for Economic and Policy Research paper says the International Monetary Fund has been pushing for lower spending, shrinking government, and cutting social programs in European Union member countries, often regardless of a country's specific economic circumstances. The center says these austerity policies, including public pension and health care cuts and raising the retirement ages, can worsen the economic recession confronting Europe. The Center for Disease Control is touting the release of a new study on infections at U.S. biological laboratories as a success story. Jesse Russell reports.
Between 2004 and 2010, only 11 workers at U.S. biological laboratories were infected with dangerous pathogens. The labs employ around 10,000 workers each year, making the infection rate 1.6 in 10,000. The reporting requirement was made by Congress after 5 people were killed by anthrax in 2001. Those deaths were allegedly from letters sent by a researcher at an Army lab in Maryland. The report additionally found that between 2004 and 2010, there were 0 reported thefts and only 1 lost pathogen. That lost pathogen was attributed to an error by a commercial carrier.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
The wall.
You know, you're going to hear two numbers thrown around an awful lot. And, you know, it's, again, you know, you had Scarnati say, well, you know, we got this huge liability, $44 billion, because the pension fund has a $44 billion liability. That's making you believe there's no money in there, and everyone's retiring today. It's all, everything's going to stop, and everyone's going to take their money and leave right now. I'll tell you, if they pass what I hear they're talking about, people are going to take their money and run right now. I've talked to several people who say, you know what, if they pass the reforms and the changes and the and what they're doing, we're leaving. And that's going to make things much, much worse. And I look at this, and it really is a divide and conquer plan. This idea that if you don't take this poison, no matter what sugar we put on the poison, we're going to steal from education. And if you listen to what Zogby said the other day, he said, look, you know, if we can't cut from the pensions, we're going to cut from education. Again, pitting parents and teachers against one another. It's the classic plan, which is why I've asked Brian Sanguinito, the president of the Reading Education Association, to come talk to us about this. It is what it is. It's a pension theft, in my view. Brian, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You know, I look at this, and to me, it's classic divide and conquer, pitting you against parents, you really against the kids is what they're trying to do. I'm curious, what are your, just off the top, what are your thoughts?
Well, see, the problem with Tom Corbett is he's stealing from the working man, and he's trying to now put the blame on the working man for his actions. This is false choices. These are false choices that Tom Corbett is presenting. He's saying that we're going to tie, the state is going to tie funding for students on teacher pensions. That's a false choice. It's a red herring. The fact is that the government of this Commonwealth decided to take a holiday when our hardworking teachers were giving their fair share of their contributions to their retirement. All of a sudden, the bills came due, and now Tom Corbett's saying, you know what, we don't feel like paying, so we're going to take it on this.
I wish I could do that. I wish when I had a mortgage, I could say, you know what, I'm going to keep my house, but you know what? I'm not paying you anymore, Mr. Banker. I mean, because to me, it's the basic, you've signed a contract.
Absolutely, and what he's trying to do is unconstitutional, too, and he's going to go around saying that they're not going to make changes for current employees with the monies that we've already earned. I can't believe that somebody that was the Attorney General of this Commonwealth has tried to screw over the Constitution so much. It just blows my mind. And this is an orchestrated attack against public workers. It's an orchestrated attack against unions. You know, we have 187,000 members in the Pennsylvania State Education Association, 1,100 of whom I represent in Reading. And those numbers in our unions keep dwindling because there's a systematic attempt to dismantle the unions, and especially with the teachers' union, where they go after your pension. And how can you talk about pensions being good for schools? You can't. That is just an attack on the working class.
Yeah, I mean, you brought up the false choices thing, which is something that I've been saying. You know, they're saying, well, you know, we got to take from the kids and from the classroom, because we're going to have to give, the number they keep throwing out is $511 million, because that's what they're going to have to pay in pension increases, because again, you know, we had this massive collapse, and for about a decade they stopped making payments. Never mind that. But they keep throwing this number out and say, we're going to have to steal it from kids in the education layup for people, without really thinking about how much money, how many hundreds of millions of dollars we've given away in tax breaks, and how many hundreds of millions of dollars we've allowed to flow through that magic box in Delaware. And, you know, you want to give me a choice? If the Republicans claim to be pro-choice on education, why not give me that option?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, tens of thousands of teaching jobs have been lost in Pennsylvania under Tom Corbett's leadership. And back in 2010, there was pension reform that was passed, which adversely affected newer employees. The contribution rate in order to get what current employees were getting in 2010 had to increase just to get the same thing. So we kept our share of the promise. We were contributing the same thing when the stock market was up, when the stock market was down. Teachers were contributing their fair share. We're not the ones who took a holiday. But it's to the point where the state needs to keep its promise. And we teach our kids, you know, we teach our kids math, science, social studies, reading, music, art. We teach them a lot of things, but we also teach them about integrity, and we also teach them about how important it is to keep their promise. And the governor, who used to be a teacher, needs to be able to teach our kids about keeping a promise. He's going to set a real agenda here and say, you know what, are we going to allow the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to try to renege on its promise to the hardworking employees of this state or not?
Yeah, I mean, and that's an excellent way of putting it, because the message that I keep hearing is from friends of mine who look at this and really don't have, don't have a skin in the game. They go, well, you know what, they stole my pension, so I guess the message is, and what Corbett is planning on and what the Republicans are hoping for, is that people will look at you and go, well, I lost my pension, the company I worked for was able to screw me, you're next.
Right, and it is divide and conquer, like you say all the time, Rick. It's divide and conquer politics. Our job in public education is to educate the public about what's really going on. I mean, really, we teach our kids, and we need to help educate the public about what really is happening in our schools. You know, when we went into teaching, college-educated professionals went into teaching, we knew that we weren't going to make as much, especially in a poor city like Reading. We knew we weren't going to make as much at the beginning of our careers as somebody who went into the private sector. But at the end of the day, we knew that the money that we earned now, that tax-deferred payment, was going to be available to us later on when we decided to retire. And instead of taking care of our neighbor's kids, we got to take care of our grandkids. Now we're in a situation where people who've been teaching for 25, 30 years who are banking on that money, which, again, we've already earned to be there, government is now trying to say, you know what, we're going to take that away. This is morally reprehensible what Tom Corbett and his cronies are doing, and we need to stop it.
Yeah, I wouldn't say the government's trying to. It's Tom Corbett and the Republicans who want to take it away.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, you look at this, and to me, as I look at this scheme, it's another privatization scheme to me. It's another way to get Wall Street hands into your retirement, into the state's retirement system, so that you can, and I guess it's like any con game if you look at it the way I do. You separate people from the knowledge and experience, you know, the people who run the pension funds, put it into the hands of individuals so that you can, well, you can rip them off.
Well, you hit the nail on the head, too. It's all about privatization. I was honored to talk to you back in June, and I mentioned some of the same things that I'm talking about today because it's still happening. You know, this is a systematic attempt to privatize education because it's a multi-billion dollar industry waiting to happen, and Tom Corbett and his cronies can't wait to get their hands on it. They did it with a lottery, or at least trying to do it with a lottery, and I'm hoping Kathleen Kane does the right thing and rejects that. That's just my opinion. They're trying to do it with the turnpike, they're trying to do it with liquor stores, and then they're going to try to do it with the schools. Tom Corbett has never seen a public industry that he did not want to privatize. because it's all about who's going to be able to contribute to his next campaign.
And there's something seriously wrong with that. Even if you're a diehard, a rock rib red Republican, you cannot look at that and say that's good for the Commonwealth. That's good for the direction of we the people of this Commonwealth.
And I think two things, and this isn't necessarily a popular answer, and that's fine. But I think that, you know, when I talk to people throughout the state, when I do travel, leave your hands off our guns, leave your hands off of our schools. You know, and I really think that if we're fighting this hard, but if there's that much talk about putting a gun in every teacher's hand, which is a totally different topic, and that's a different topic altogether, which we can debate for hours. But if there's enough money for that, then there's certainly enough money for smaller class sizes. There's certainly enough money for pre-kindergarten. There's certainly enough money for Pennsylvania to keep its promise to its public employees. This is an attack by Tom Corbett and his cronies on the middle class, because the unions are the only thing that preserve the middle class in this country.
I'm right there with you. You know, I look at this, and if we've got the money to put a gun in every classroom, maybe we have enough money to fix the classroom so when it snows, the snow doesn't come into the classroom. As I've been told, there are a few in Reading that actually happens in.
Absolutely. We had CNN in the last year, and we had the National Education Association up just recently to talk about those kind of issues. You know, we're talking about safe schools. When I talk about a safe school, I want to make sure that I have students going to a classroom when it's 10 degrees outside, that it's actually comfortable inside. I went into a classroom the other day. The kids needed to go get their jackets because it was so cold, but yet we're not worrying about that. We're worrying about a false choice as far as guns in schools and teachers. You know, you want to keep kids safe, keep them away from guns. Don't introduce them to more guns. And again, that's a different topic for a different time. But at the end of the day, all these proposals, even the 401k proposals that you're hearing now, from Corbett, that does nothing to actually reduce the Commonwealth pension debt.
It actually makes it worse.
It actually does make it worse. And you look at all the other places that have tried to institute that, and it's made it worse. But people don't want to listen to facts. Well, I'll tell you, I'll talk about facts because I'm a teacher and we deal with facts. You know, the fact is that over the past 2 years, state funding for my district alone was decreased under Tom Corbett's budget by $33 million, and statewide it's been billions. Another fact, teachers have continue to contribute their fair share, and the state government under 10 years ago and continuing on now decided to kick the can down the road. And another fact is the pension reform was already passed a few years ago and adversely affected our new employees, and now Corbett's coming after public employee benefits again.
And that pretty much lays it out. Let me ask you a last line of questioning, because I've spoken with a couple of friends who are teachers, and they say, look, if what we're hearing is going to happen, if Tom Corbett and the Republicans do what is being put out in the media, there's going to be a 401k defined contribution. They're going to go after existing pensions, existing plans, and reduce that stuff. I got people telling me, hey, we've got master's degrees and PhDs. We're employable elsewhere. We're going. We're going to take our money and we're leaving. And what is that going to leave for our education system?
Well, there's already very little incentive to come teach in our public schools as far as the working conditions that are happening now, the attacks against union workers that are happening now. You know, our teachers want to be able to pursue the American dream. They want to be able to work hard, make a positive difference in their little corner of the world because of how committed they are to the students. And yet, we have an American dream that if we do work hard, we make that positive difference, one day we're going to be able to retire comfortably. It's called the pursuit of happiness, Rick. And I believe that Tom Corbett doesn't believe that middle-class workers and public sector employees deserve that pursuit of happiness. And that's why what we have to do is we have to rise up, and stand up against Tom Corbett and say, you know what, enough is enough. It's time you start treating our people, our citizens, with respect, and that you put as much time and money into public education as you do into defending private corporations.
Oh, and you look at the money, it's mind-blowing. Well, so just in the 2 years, something like $400 million in tax breaks because of the bonus depreciation rules, and something like $360 million by reducing the capital stock and franchise tax, and the list goes on. I think it was almost $1 billion over 2 years that they've given away while taking from $1 billion a year from public education and just eviscerating other social safety net programs. Again, I go back to the false choice thing. Well, there's plenty of money there. We're just allocating it in the wrong direction.
And I've said this to you before, and I'll say it to you again, I'll say it to my dying day. You can either choose money or you can choose people, but at the end of the day, I will always choose what's right for people.
I'm hoping that this is one of those moments where people rise up and say enough already and turn this back. And the polls are showing this governor not popular at all.
Right, and we have to make sure that we continue to communicate with one another. We have a website in which we have all of our advocacy efforts. It's wearerea.com. And what we do in the Reading Education Association, we fight the fight, whether it's a local fight, a regional fight, or a state fight. We're willing to fight it because at the end of the day, we know that our students' success depends on what we do for them as their education association, just like it's our members' education association.
Brian, I appreciate the work that you do. Keep up the fight, and love to have you back again real soon.
Thank you, brother. Thank you.
Brian Sanguinito, president of the Reading Education Association. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
Corruption not very well known, but a consumer code of silence is what they did then. We know it, so let's don't pretend. You and me know it, so let's don't pretend.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
AFSCME, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
What a satisfying sight it would have been for the public to see Lloyd Blankfein, Jamie Dimon, and other high-rolling Wall Street banksters in handcuffs for having illegally foreclosed on the homes of hundreds of thousands of American families. But no, instead of the kingpins of finance finally having to take responsibility for evicting so many people and wrecking the nation's housing market, not a single one has even been pursued by the law. Rather, federal regulators have negotiated a secret deal with Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and nine other mortgage lending giants, letting banks pay $10 billion in penalties to end the case against them. The lesson here is clear. If your crime is vast enough, forget doing time. You don't even personally pay the fine. You just unleash your mad dog lawyers to cut a deal, shifting the cost of your felonious profiteering scheme onto your bank shareholders. Letting the chief schemers deflect responsibility also has zero deterrent effect on their future scheming, and it destroys public trust in the notion of equal justice for all. It's not fair, we shout in exasperation. But the big shots shout back, fair? That's where you take your pig to win a blue ribbon. This is Wall Street, baby. Grab all you can. So they're still there, still scheming, profiting, and grinning. In the same week that Goldman Sachs agreed to pay a fine for its illicit treatment of homeowners, it announced that CEO Lloyd Blankfein was awarded some $19 million in pay, including a $6 million bonus. Likewise, J.P. Morgan agreed to a sweetheart settlement for its mortgage malfeasance. Then, a week later, it delivered an $11.5 million paycheck to its chief, Jamie Dimon. This is Jim Hightower saying, anyone who says crime doesn't pay simply is not paying attention to Wall Street.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed, with your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed.
Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
So here again, I look at this, and that whole frame of false choices, this whole idea that these are your only, the Tina argument, there's no alternative, we have to do this, this or this. These are your choices. A comedian did a skit on cake or death. Like, there's really a choice there. Cake or death. Like, you have a choice. And this is kind of the way that they're framing this whole debate around pensions. Personally, I don't think there's a debate here. There's a contract. You've done things to fix those contracts. People started their employment. That's how it should be. What we've allowed in this country is contracts work for you and me. When we sign a mortgage contract, we're the ones who we've got to pay. But when the mortgage company screws up and, well, they break the contract, a little forgiveness. When it's the wealth class that screws things up, we made a little mistake. But when it's the folks at the bottom, well, the heck with them. And I see this pension thing, it's theft is what it is. And it's so many of the things that I despise in how we've allowed ourselves to be cut up and sliced and diced and divided. You look at Act 120. What Act 120 did is it threw the next generation down the hole. Lengthened the amount of time that you have to be vested from, I think it was 5 to 10 years. If you stay 7 years, sorry, you're out of luck. And the point of that is simply to go, well, you know what? We should have a defined contribution plan so you could keep that money. Look, they threw you down the hole. And these were all arguments that we made back when they were arguing this. Everything that the business class does, everything that business friendly does is for a reason. They've thought it through. They've come up with their plan. And they, because there's money involved, lots of it. And we keep giving these huge handouts and these huge tax breaks and all of this stuff. And for what? So that we can be held hostage again. And you look at this governor who has completely walked away from education on so many levels. And I guess it's just not this governor. It's a lot of governors throughout the country. It's the presidents. I saw this thing the other day. A report out by the Fair Isaac Corporation. They crunch numbers and do all of this stuff. They were looking at student loan debt in the country. And they said from 2005 to 2007, the delinquency rate of the student loans were about 12.4%. From 2010 to 2012, jumped all the way up to 15.1. They pointed out that during the 2005 to 2007 era, on average, U.S. student loans about $17,000. By 2012, $27,523, an increase of almost 60%. And you go, well, why has that happened? Back to those false choices. Well, we need money for corporations, so we have to give it to them. So there's no money for education, so we're going to have to cut those budgets. And they did. They cut them massively. And then they said, well, we'll put some of it back so we don't look like such bad guys. And us bought it. I mean, when Sue Helm, I play the clip all the time of her going, well, you know, originally we took the money, but we put it back. No, you didn't. You put some back. You know, if I rob a bank of $1 million and I give $50 back, did I put the money back? Well, that's basically what they've done. They've robbed the education bank and given it away so that they'll get political campaign contributions. I mean, this is not difficult stuff to figure out. But it's what we've allowed to happen. You think over the last 2 years, $975 million that we've given away to corporations while we're gutting education, while we're gutting social services, while we're gutting low-wage workers' health care. And they're telling us, oh, I'm sorry, we can't expand Medicaid to cover all of the citizens in the state with some measure of health security. Sorry, we don't have any money. Yeah, you know why we don't have any money? We're giving it away. But they're job creators, Rick. Oh, yeah. Where have the job numbers gone? Oh yeah, we've actually lost jobs. Austerity does not work. Doesn't. And it blows my mind that we're still buying into this. And I look at this report out from the Congressional Research Service. They've pointed out what we've already known, that these huge multinational corporations, and again, it comes back to what we allow to happen in our country. This is our country. Believe it or not, you and I are the voters of this country, ours. We dictate what happens in our country, not the huge multinationals. I know the Romneys of the world want those companies to be people, but they're not. But you look at what we've allowed to happen through our insane trade agreements and through our insane trade tax policies. According to their findings, in 2008, American multinational corporations reported 43% of their $940 billion in overseas profits in five tax haven countries. Five countries, 43% of their profits. Even though only 4% of their foreign workforce and 7% of their foreign investment were in those countries. Much like Delaware, you're talking about a P.O. box. They point out that U.S. multinational foreign profits were reported in Bermuda equaled 1,000% of the little country's total economic output. 1,000%. Look at Luxembourg, where in 1999, business profits jumped from 19% of that country's economy all the way up to 208% of the country's economy by 2008. Think about that. Delaware loophole on a massive scale. Or the Luxembourg loophole, you pick. And you go, well, what's that matter? Well, it matters because you go back to those students who have taken on this massive student loan. You go back to the public school teacher who's getting screwed out of their pension. You go back to the worker who's getting screwed out of their pension and health care and their wages. And you go, where's all that money going? Oh, yeah, to a P.O. box in Delaware or Luxembourg. This is why we need to wake up. These trade deals that they keep ramming down, both parties are equally responsible for our insane trade agreements. Because the big money dictates. And I go back to what the old man always told me. If a rich guy's going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you had better damn well spend two to get it. And we had better wake up. Because we're being led down the absolute wrong path. And we come back, I want to talk about this wine and spirits shops that, again, our governor. Let's sell off because, well, $2 billion. No. I can't wait to hear what he's got to say tomorrow. Quick break, right back after this.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Earth. Sky.
When does the age of Aquarius begin? And what is the age of Aquarius?
The age of Aquarius isn't part of astronomy. It's an astrological age, which occurs because of a real motion of Earth known as the precession of the equinoxes. The cycle of precession lasts 25,800 years. There are 12 constellations in the zodiac.
So roughly every 2,150 years, the sun's position at the time of the March equinox moves in front of a new zodiac constellation. The age of Aquarius is said to begin when the equinox point moves out of Pisces and into the constellation Aquarius.
But there's no definitive answer as to when that will be. From an astronomical point of view, the International Astronomical Union created official constellation boundaries as recently as 1930. Based on those boundaries, the March equinox will cross over into the constellation Aquarius in the year 2597.
Meanwhile, Nicholas Campion at the University of Wales has studied astrologers' ideas about when we enter the age of Aquarius. They range from the year 1447 AD to the year 3597 AD. So, even among astrologers, there's no consensus as to when the age of Aquarius begins.
For more, search on Aquarius at earthsky.org. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Mike Brennan. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
What keeps you up at night, Governor? What part of all of those worries concerns you the most? The cuts, the tax
cuts? Usually I wake up about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I wonder where we are going to balance the budget. We have a pension crisis just like every other state just about has a pension crisis.
You've had success. I want our viewers to know you've balanced 2 previous budgets, if not more. Right. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, you've closed deficit holes of more than $4 billion. You've had success.
You've had success, yes, slashing education, slashing funding for the most needy, most vulnerable. Yeah, that's it. If that's success, wow. The definition of that word has really changed since I was in school. And I guess that's why they're pushing to privatize education, so they can change the definition so that it'll fit their needs. That's all I can come up with. Anyway, welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Our quote of the day from Pennsylvania Speaker of the House, Sam Smith. He says, I just feel there's a hybrid in there that succeeds in privatizing, but doesn't necessarily limit the service structure that exists today. He says, a hybrid gets you to privatization with minimum destruction to the people that have a vested interest in the system as it is today. He says of the wine and spirit shops, a hybrid gets you to the privatization with minimum destruction to the people that have vested interest in the system today. Admitting that when we privatize this, those workers, the people who have for years been dedicated employees to the state serving done, destroyed. He knows that. But they're still going to pursue it. And tomorrow at 2 o'clock, we're going to find out what our governor's got to say about it. But tonight, I'm going to talk to John Judkovich. He is a state employee, works at the wine and spirit shops. John, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, Rick. I'm glad you called.
I appreciate you taking time. I look at this, and you know, Speaker Smith says he wants a hybrid of some way of privatizing the wine and spirit shops in a way that... Oh, we could privatize some and the state would own some in a way that would have minimal destruction to the people who have a vested interest today. When you hear that, what do you think?
That's not been true in other states. It begins kind of a death by a thousand cuts. From what I know, different things that were floating around, one would allow beer and wine in the grocery stores up to case lots.
Right.
And not like the beer in the grocery stores now where you have to go off into the cafe area. You load it in your cart, you go through an aisle, you go out the door. Losing the wine part would hurt the PLCB terribly, and there's other people with interests. There's the family-owned beer distributors all across Pennsylvania. Who's going to make that second stop at the beer distributor now that they can go into the big box grocery store, throw it in their cart with their groceries, and come out the door? They're going to lose, too. There's a lot of moving parts here and a lot of vested interests. And I think most important are our shareholders, the stakeholders, the people of Pennsylvania that own these stores now. We haven't ever seen a plan that would be revenue neutral and guarantee them the return they're getting on what I do at my job now.
Right. And not to mention all of the other things that would come along with privatization, all of the societal ills, the fact that we would lose a 1% tax that we now collect, that we would have to give like we give every retailer who pays their taxes on time. And there's a lot of moving parts, as you've pointed out. And unfortunately, the way I see it, me as a taxpayer, we as the Commonwealth, we all lose.
Exactly. You want to take a look at how you lose. There's a natural experiment that's been going on in Washington State. As you know, or you should know, these people, they privatized their stores by referendum last year, began June 1st. They auctioned off their old liquor stores. They had about 380. They got $30 million. Nowhere near the projections we're getting that's supposed to fund our transportation and infrastructure. And as a result, prices actually went up because they tried to make that revenue neutral. So they added a fee that all it did was cover the profits the Washington state system used to make.
Right.
And you would think privatization, private business is supposed to be more efficient. They were supposed to be able to cover that and still make money. Uh-huh. Prices went up 10 to 30%. The selection went down because in order to have cash flow, you just got to move fast movers. Along the borders in Oregon and Idaho, those are state-controlled states. They've actually opened stores, expanded store hours because of the border bleed going across from the private state to the publicly owned states of Idaho, publicly owned stores in Idaho and Oregon.
Interesting. That's something.
Overall, though, the consumption increased in Washington because besides those 380 stores they sold off, it was now open up any store with, I think it was 10,000 square feet or more, any big box.
Wow.
So now there are like 2,000 outlets. It's in your face all the time. You alluded to the social costs. Well, there might actually be a little more revenue coming in because of this increased consumption and including what's coming across the border. I'm hoping for Washington more of that is people are switching from beer to liquor because the increased social costs are going to outweigh the increased revenue they're taking in. There's no way you can do it. There have been other problems, shoplifting by both juveniles and organized gangs because grocery stores weren't used to handling this product they're handling now. I mean, it's high resale and highly desirable. There's actually a video on YouTube showing kids in Washington how they steal. They go through the self-service checkout lines, if you've ever seen them in some grocery stores.
Yep.
The idea is you don't just try to steal the bottle. You try to slip it into a box of donuts or something. It's on YouTube. You can look it up.
Well, no, I mean, I lived it. Here's the thing, John. I lived it. When I was a teenager back in the 80s, we went to I grew up in Cleveland. And there they had, it was an impulse item. It was right there next to the Tic Tacs. You know,
uh-huh.
14, 15 years old, I was able to go into these stores and buy right off the counter, and where we couldn't buy, you know, someone would just slip in their jacket and walk off. You can't do that here. That doesn't work here. And that's what I like about the system. Because,
well,
you know, I've become this hypocritical animal known as a parent now. And I don't want my kids to have the same access that I have.
Well, that is a great attitude because, that is what will happen. I mean, when you open it up to more accessibility, it means more accessibility for everybody, both the people who should have it, the people who shouldn't have it.
And I look at this, and the way I'm seeing it being structured now is it's something that I think they're going to add into or try and tie into either the pension fight or the transportation bill, and it's going to be one of those things. It's a bargaining chip meant to divide the workers and their unions and taxpayers and their assets.
And you're right describing it as an asset. Like I said before, the people are the stakeholders. They're getting a return on this every year monetarily and in social responsibility. You know, public ownership equals public responsibility and public revenue. And that's the way it's been run here now. It's been run for 70 years. It's the way it works. It can be modernized. Senator Scarnati again alluded to that.
Today, yes.
We could do a little bit to increase the consumer experience, maybe some better store hours, more stores right next to or even within grocery stores.
Well, let me ask you about that, John, because, you know, I've heard a lot about the modernization, and the first question that pops into my mind is, you know, why haven't we done that in the past? Why haven't we allowed some expansion, some reasonable expansion, so that some folks who may want a certain product to be more accessible, why haven't we done that? Why would we then go, we've had a very controlled thing that's worked very well. When I want whatever it is I want, I know where to get it, to now we're going to fling the doors open, and it's the Wild West of liquor.
Right. Well, why haven't we done modernization so far? A lot of it takes legislative action. Right now, I'm in Erie. My rep, Kurt Sonny, has had a direct wine shipping bill where people could have wine shipped directly to their house from wineries only, as long as they pay the state taxes. And this isn't the kind of thing kids are going to do for senior skip day. That's not how they're going to order their wine. First of all, most things, once you apply our taxes, there's shipping charges from wineries. We're not talking about, winesforless.com. We're talking right from the winery. That's going to help the niche buyer. That's something
right.
that they would like. And we really don't have any opposition to. I mean, me in particular. And it helps our local, our in-state business wineries because it would allow them to ship out of state. That isn't going to cut into the state's business. When you let the big box grocery store direct ship right from a winery and they take away the bulk wines, the box wines, the products most people buy. I was thinking about this last Thanksgiving. What a hit is that on our business, and what kind of revenue hit is it, and how hard is it for us to remain increasingly profitable, which we've been for the last 20 years?
Exactly.
You know, it's a step backwards.
Well, the reason I brought up Sam Smith's comment is because, you know, he wants this hybrid situation where we sell off the most profitable, and then the state gets stuck with, well, with the not profitable ones, because understand, and I try and explain this to my friends who live in rural areas. You have a wine and spirit shop in your neighborhood because the state as a whole says we're going to cover the entire state and give consumers the opportunity throughout the state. If we go to this privatized model, do you think you're going to have something in rural areas? No. And if you do, it's going to be the corner gas station.
Well, that's it. Yeah. What kind of wine do you want, red or white? Do you want vodka? Yeah, we got that. We got gin. What kind can I get? We got vodka, we got chip. But that's another part. Whatever, you know, I talked about revenue neutral before. It should guarantee all the stakeholders, all the public that owns the store right now, equal service. Yep. Any bill they should run should guarantee that, and I'll guarantee you they can't do that the way we do because we have the infrastructure right now.
Last question I've
got
for you.
Any store, you can be the littlest store in Punk Seat, wherever. St. Mary's, PA, Marionville, PA, if anybody even knows where that is, has a little store. They can order from that same catalog we do, including the SLO thing. It's 30,000 different items. If somebody lives in town and they want it, they can get it.
Yep. Last question I've got.
Is that going to happen from the corner gas station?
Yeah. Last question. I got 30 seconds left. You know, what is this going to mean if we go through with the privatization scheme that our governor's talking about? What does it mean for the 3,000 employees of the wine and spirit shops?
Job loss. Job loss multiplier effect. Getting back to Washington, I saw an article just before Christmas where a trucking company that did a lot of the delivery for Washington State out of business, laid off, well, not out of business, laid off hundreds of people just before Thanksgiving. Same thing that happened to them, and I feel for everybody would happen to us.
Yeah, well, that will be the legacy of this governor. John, I appreciate
Hopefully
the time.
It won't.
I'm hoping you're right. I'm hoping we can push back on this, which is why I'm glad you took some time and filled us in. I appreciate the time, John.
Thanks for calling, Rick.
John Zudkovich. Works with the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board employee there. I'm telling you, this is a ripoff top to bottom. Quick break, back with hour two.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every week. From 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Nissan workers struggling to form a union at the automaker's Canton, Mississippi plant got support Tuesday from civil rights leaders, actor Danny Glover, as well as student and community activists. The workers want Nissan to be neutral and allow workers a fair election to decide whether or not to be represented by the United Auto Workers. Derek Johnson, president of Mississippi's NAACP, supports a union for these Nissan workers.
When workers go to work on Monday, they don't know whether they're going to work a four-hour day or 12-hour day. They have no idea whether it's going to be a 4-day week or a 7-day week. They are pretty much held captive until the plant decides they can come and go.
Johnson says labor's struggle is a civil rights struggle for justice, and this Mississippi Nissan Workers Union organizing effort has national implications.
We see this as a civil rights issue. We see this as a national movement. We understand that what happens in the South as it relates to organized labor could make the difference whether or not organized labor exists in this country, because it is the new battleground where the Midwest and the Northeastern states had a long, hard fight to organize. And as a result of that, you had individuals across racial lines, across gender, who are able to move up into the middle class. But in the South, where we have right-to-work states, where we have low union density, we see this as our opportunity to raise up the South, create a new paradigm, and allow workers to truly appreciate the benefit of their labor and increase the quality of their life.
A new Center for Economic and Policy Research paper says the International Monetary Fund has been pushing for lower spending, shrinking government, and cutting social programs in European Union member countries, often regardless of a country's specific economic circumstances. The center says these austerity policies, including public pension and health care cuts and raising the retirement ages, can worsen the economic recession confronting Europe. The Center for Disease Control is touting the release of a new study on infections at U.S. biological laboratories as a success story. Jesse Russell reports.
Between 2004 and 2010, only 11 workers at U.S. biological laboratories were infected with dangerous pathogens. The labs employ around 10,000 workers each year, making the infection rate 1.6 in 10,000. The reporting requirement was made by Congress after 5 people were killed by anthrax in 2001. Those deaths were allegedly from letters sent by a researcher at an Army lab in Maryland. The report additionally found that between 2004 and 2010, there were 0 reported thefts and only 1 lost pathogen. That lost pathogen was attributed to an error by a commercial carrier.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show. I got a bad case.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app. Take the program on the go. So tomorrow, the governor is going to roll out the big privatization scheme, going back after the wine and spirit shops. And I hear a lot of rumors going to tie it to the pension situation. Again, another manufactured crisis. Going to tie it to transportation. Where's this all going to go? Where are these attacks going to come from? Which is why I've asked Rick Bloomingdale, president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, to come talk to us about this pension and much more. Rick, thanks for taking time for me.
Rick, it's always a pleasure to be on the show.
So I saw Senator Scarnati's press conference today. Pensions, the big thing, the budget, transportation. He himself said we shouldn't be linking things to any of that stuff.
Well, and we shouldn't. I mean, it's such a false choice and a zero-sum game. Right, I mean, pensions are part of the cost, employee cost, and they've been doing this for, 90 years, making sure that people had pensions and health care. I mean, the trade-off in public employment, lower wages was always the benefit package was a little better, and that continues to be true. The average state employee makes much less than the average private sector worker, and they make up for that with a little bit better with a pension, a defined benefit plan, and health care. Now, that's not to say the private sector shouldn't have those. They should have those things. Everybody should have a pension. And what we're seeing in this country is people staying at work longer because their 401ks aren't enough for them to retire on. And as I was listening to the Independent News Network talking about how people aren't being able to retire and move into and opening up jobs for our young people. So this whole idea that you have to tie one to the other, there are other ways to raise revenues And, you know, the governor needs to take a look at those rather than trying to take things away from hardworking folks.
Now, I got a couple of ideas on how we can raise revenue. Maybe stop giving all this money away to big corporations, something like $1 billion over the last 2 years, and maybe take a look at that magical box there in Delaware, the loophole. Maybe start thinking about that before we commit the Commonwealth to breaking our promises to the workers who have so faithfully served our Commonwealth.
Well, and that's, you know, that's the other frustrating thing is that, you know, and they all admit that the workers had nothing to do with this crisis, right? It was two recessions in 8 years. It was elected officials putting off paying their part of this, you know, zero funding in a couple of years. But yet they admit that it wasn't their fault. But when it comes to solving it, that's who they want to solve it on the backs of, rather than those who did have some responsibility, corporations who walked away and are still walking away with billions of dollars of profits, not paying their fair share of taxes in Pennsylvania, yet making money off of Pennsylvania consumers. You're right, Steve. Rick, it would easily be easy to close the Delaware tax loophole, which would generate enough money to cover any kind of pension costs, health care costs, employee costs. We could have a good state government, good teaching. We have great teachers. We could give them the resources they need to do their job even better, to make our schools world class, if we gave them enough revenue to do their jobs.
Now, you know, you mentioned the two recessions, and I find it interesting that Senator Scarnati brought that up as well. He said that's really what's to blame. You know, it's a little bit of the legislature not doing their thing and a little bit of all the other stuff, but it was really the recessions. What I found interesting about the statement, though, is generally his party, they're the ones who say we should not be regulating the people who caused that situation. And, oh, by the way, we're going to look to them to fix it. It kind of makes me leery of their not only their ideology, but their solutions to the problems that they've created.
Well, and, you know, just like any organization that's made up of human beings, the Republican Party has varying degrees of ideology. Senator Scarnati is probably one of the more pragmatic, smarter members of that organization. And it is two recessions. One, not caused by anybody except the terrorists of Al-Qaeda, the 9/11 recession, caused by that tragedy. But the second one was absolutely manufactured by the greed on Wall Street and by giving away tax breaks and money and deregulating a lot of industries where they caused the huge collapse, much worse than the recession of 2001, near destroyed our economy with their unregulated banking schemes, with their stock schemes, with their housing schemes. It literally nearly bankrupted the American economy. And as far as I know, they still haven't been held to account, and we could do a little bit of that by making them pay their fair share in taxes.
Yeah, and I'm all in favor of a construction project of building a new San Quentin for those criminals on Wall Street to be locked up in. Let me ask you this. How much of what we're seeing before us with the pension situation is this idea? And as I sat and listened to the testimony that Daryl Metcalf's committee had, I got this weird feeling that he believes that government should be the leader in the race to the bottom, and we should be running government like a corporation. So the end game is maybe I see it, and maybe you've got an opinion on it, is doing what we've allowed to happen to the private sector worker. You cause these crises, you put the workers through bankruptcy, you eliminate their pensions, throw it on the back of the PBGC, cut them in half, and, well, they're happy, except the workers got screwed. How much of this do you see as part of the way they're trying to go about this?
Maybe I was brought up different, but I don't get guys like Daryl Metcalf who want to put workers in the poorhouse, all under the guise of helping them. It reminds me of the book 1984, where, you know, the lies become the truth and the truth becomes the lies. These guys absolutely are the puppets of their Wall Street masters, who are trying to take the wealth that Americans create every day, that workers create every day by going to work, doing their services, creating their products, whatever it is they do to contribute to the economy. These guys want to shift that little bit of money they make from their productivity even more into the hands of the wealthy. I think that these folks would be happy if everybody was making $8 an hour, or if they could repeal the minimum wage, $5 an hour. And I don't get it. I don't know why they want people to be in poverty. I just don't understand it.
So, you know, and I guess, you know, you look at the billionaire Gina Reinhart from Australia, where they actually, the Australian minimum wage is about $16 an hour, who said that, well, you know, those people, those poor people, they shouldn't socialize and drink and talk so much. They should work, and they should be like those people in Africa who make $2 a day. That's how they're going to get wealthy. And I guess that's a very interesting way of looking at it. So let me ask you, you know, how do we fix this? Because there are some who say there's a very real problem here. They keep throwing this $41 or $44 billion number out. If you could talk to that for a second, I'd appreciate it. But how do we fix this?
Well, I mean, the $41 billion unfunded liabilities, it's a bogus number, right? And, you know, what an unfunded liability is how much would you need if everybody retired on the same day? So, you know, if the state went belly up, that's your unfunded liability. Now, I've asked the governor, I've asked the legislators, if they are planning on retiring tomorrow. I've asked school teachers and state employees, are you leaving tomorrow? Are you going to take your money out so that we're short $41 billion? As far as I know, everybody in the state is going to go to work tomorrow, work hard, make their paycheck, make their pension contribution, and keep paying into the system. And, you know, some folks are retiring, and they will take their money out of the system. But that's how it's supposed to work, right? You pay into it, you earn your time, you do your time, you earn your money, you contribute, and that's what most people don't understand. State employees, school district employees contribute 6.25% to 7.25% of their pay every payday. Every hour they work. So the $41 billion is a phony number. One real problem is because the Commonwealth did not put money in when times were good. And at one point, the pension was funded 130%. And hence, you know, and then the two recessions, and now it's not funded 100%, it's at 65%. So there is a problem to make sure that the pension gets healthy, and healthy is usually considered around 80%. So what do you do to fix that? Well, we've made some changes in 2010. It was called Act 120. They changed vesting for state employees and school district employees from 5 years to 10 years. So now, you know, a person, their money stays in if they leave before 10 years. I mean, they take out their contributions, but the money the state put in for them stays in the system. So that builds up, takes you a little longer to get vested. They reduce the multiplier. The multiplier had been 2.5. So if you worked there 20 years and, and you were 62, you'd get 50% of your salary after 20 years. They've reduced that to 2. So now you would get, after 20 years, 40% of your salary.
Right.
And, and they also, I'm trying to think, the average, and now this is all for new employees who started July 1st, 2011, or maybe January 1st, 2011. Those changes all impact those folks. So there is a way to solve this problem. Now, the state does have to make their contributions. They should have been making them all along.
Right.
And some of the administration are saying, well, you know, this money is going to take away from other things, but that's baloney because they've always made or should have always made those contributions. And so the way to fix it, you know, the great thing about pensions is you really can wait a while because people tend to work 30 to 40 years. So you have time to fix these problems. It's not an emergency. So if you let Act 120 work, and let, you know, as people retire, those new employees come in at lower benefits, because everybody should have good benefits. You're going to solve the problem. I think by 2020 or 2025, the number starts to go down where the state is contributing. Like I said, if they close the Delaware loophole, get businesses to pay their fair share, they're fine.
Yep. At the end of this, it comes down to creating jobs and getting people back to work and getting people paying into the system instead of cutting 20,000 education professionals over the last couple of years who many of them were probably paying into the system. Maybe that would help. What do you think?
Absolutely. Job creation is the key.
Maybe that's what we should be.
In the public sector, and if you're creating jobs in the private sector, people are paying their income tax, so there's less the Commonwealth can put in the proper amount of money. You don't have to, you can create a fairer tax system. And, it all works out if you create jobs that pay well.
Yep.
3% on an $8 an hour job is not same as 3% on a $20 an hour job. We need to be creating those $20 to $30 an hour jobs.
I'm right there with you. Last question I've got for you. The governor tomorrow is going to roll out another plan to privatize the wine and spirit shops. Do you think he's going to tie that to transportation or the pensions?
Well, I'm sure he's going to try, but as Senator Scarnati has already said, those are false choices. Look, the state wine and spirits shops generate $500 million a year for the Commonwealth, even under the most optimistic projections that the crazy right wing had. If you look realistically, you're only going to get about $500 million one time. And so why not take the money you're making and keep making it over every year? Right? Why say, oh, we're going to take a one-time infusion of $500 million? Well, wait a minute. The state system, the wine and spirit shops put that into your budget every year, Governor. So we really, it's such a, it's an ideological thing. It really has nothing to do. But it's worked. It's kept underage folks from getting a hold of hard liquor. It makes sure that, people who have, there's money for helping people with alcohol problems. It's been a system that works. And, people should think about, they say it's an old system, but it's an old system that works. And maybe other states should think about doing the same kind of system in order to make sure you control underage drinking and you generate some revenue for your state to provide good social services for your citizens.
Yeah, instead of us being led to the race to the bottom, maybe we should be leading that way out of the bottom. Rick,
right.
It's been great talking with you. I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Okay, Rick. Thank you.
Rick Bloomingdale, president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. Quick break with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. The working class is under attack.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? Ask Me members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
What a satisfying sight it would have been for the public to see Lloyd Blankfein, Jamie Dimon, and other high-rolling Wall Street banksters in handcuffs for having illegally foreclosed on the homes of hundreds of thousands of American families. But no, instead of the kingpins of finance finally having to take responsibility for evicting so many people and wrecking the nation's housing market, not a single one has even been pursued by the law. Rather, federal regulators have negotiated a secret deal with Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and 9 other mortgage lending giants, letting banks pay $10 billion in penalties to end the case against them. The lesson here is clear. If your crime is vast enough, forget doing time. You don't even personally pay the fine. You just unleash your mad dog lawyers to cut a deal, shifting the cost of your felonious profiteering scheme onto your bank shareholders. Letting the chief schemers deflect responsibility also has zero deterrent effect on their future scheming, and it destroys public trust in the notion of equal justice for all. It's not fair, we shout in exasperation, but the big shots shout back. Fair? That's where you take your pig to win a blue ribbon. This is Wall Street, baby. Grab all you can. So they're still there, still scheming, profiting, and grinning. In the same week that Goldman Sachs agreed to pay a fine for its illicit treatment of homeowners, it announced that CEO Lloyd Blankfein was awarded some $19 million in pay, including a $6 million bonus. Likewise, J.P. Morgan agreed to a sweetheart settlement for its mortgage malfeasance. Then, a week later, it delivered an $11.5 million paycheck to its chief, Jamie Dimon. This is Jim Hightower saying, anyone who says crime doesn't pay simply is not paying attention to Wall Street. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
How do we explain the heat? One word, summer.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick at thericksmithshow.com. So, Anthony Scalia, Southern Methodist University, Monday, giving a speech, was asked about the Constitution, asked if it is a living document. Now, I always believed it's a living, breathing document. The idea in that is that as times change, it adapts. Never in a million years did the founders think that we would have space flight, internet, telephone, where you can, I mean, when I was a kid, the amazing thing was that you'd be able to go to your house phone that was mounted to the wall, pick it up, and on a television screen, see somebody that you're talking to. I can do that with my cell phone now. So, I mean, just in my lifetime, the leaps of technology, they understood that they didn't know what was coming. So they this idea that it changes with the times. Here are a set of here are the things that we give back to our government. We have all rights, and these are what we give back, and you go from there. Well, Scalia says no. It's not a living document. It's dead, according to Scalia, which again means that. Much like the Bible people who think it's black and white, even though very little of what's in black and white. And it blows my mind that, you know, you've got these folks who think, well, you know, nothing changes. And I bring up privacy for a reason. Because privacy, back in the founding days, didn't mean what it means today. Privacy meant going to the, you know, to the outhouse. That was privacy. Now you see this story that I brought up a while when I came back from Disneyland. While I was there, some of the people were telling me about these magic bands. And you would have a wristband, like any of the rubber bands that you, for whatever cause that you have, the cause du jour. And I'm not against it, have your bands. But this band, this band would be, it would be your room key, it'd be your park passes, it would have an RFID, it'd be your credit card, it would be your RFID chip in it so that they can track your every movement, they can track your every purchase, they can track every ride you're on, they can track everything you do. Know where the kids are, know where you are, know what you're doing, when you're doing it, how long you're doing it for, all of that. And you go, privacy, right? And I understand. Now, don't get me wrong. I understand that this has nothing to do with the Constitution because, as you know, the Constitution is between me and my government, not me and Disney. I have the right to not go to Disney. I have the ability to say no to these plans, but understand what's coming. And I remember back when the whole Patriot Act was being fought. It wasn't really being fought. It was really being rammed down our throat. Just trying to, here's some sugar so the poison goes down well. I remember I went to a forum with the League of Women Voters. And they had a panel of six people. Three people who were for it, three people who were against it. And oddly enough, the three law professors who were against it had actually read every letter in the bill. The people who were for it read the political talking points. And it was apparent from the discussions that they had about the infringements on said privacy that the founders never really imagined privacy. You could be secure in your papers from the government. You could be secure in your person from the government. But they never imagined that there would be this world of magic bands. So now bring this back to the dead Constitution that says nothing about your right to privacy. You have the right to security in your persons and your papers, but not to the RFID chip. That, if I remember right, didn't exist back then. So I look at this letter that Ed Markey, a Democrat from Massachusetts, sent to Disney, you know, claiming that, well, you know, this could be harmful to our children. And it was probably, you know, a dumb thing to say. He probably should have, you know, looked a little deeper into it. Well, Disney has fired back, you know, saying, look, you know, we rolled this out and people have the option. They can do whatever they want. And by the way, you guys came up with the technology. Just a thought. But what caught my attention with this is I remember talking to people while I was at Disney. And I remember the one Tea Party guy pretty well who, you know, told me that public transportation, socialism, and, you know, the whole anti-government rant. And when we walked through the turnstile to get into the park, I turned to him and I said, you know, before we split off and go and have our day, let me ask you, what if Barack Obama's government would have sent you the census and said, we want you to put your fingerprint in the top left corner. Get an ink pad, just put your fingerprint there. What would you have said? And they said, I would have never done it. I would have crumbled it up, thrown it away, and I would have never done it. And I go, that's what I expect you to say, because I wouldn't be thrilled with it either. And I wouldn't do it either. But why did you give Disney Corporation your fingerprint? Because in order to get in with your key, with your pass, if you're staying in the resort, you put your little key in, put your fingerprint in the little scanner, because they want to make sure that it's your key, right? Why did you not think twice about giving a for-profit corporation your information? And understand that little key has a lot of information. And this magic wristband has a lot of information. Now, Disney's saying, look, you know, we've got a policy. And I'm going, well, your policy's about as good as, well, something you would wipe with. You're collecting all this information. What for? And what does that information give some power? Now, you can make the argument that logistically that, you know, we're trying to make things better and flow a little bit better. And there's a lot of arguments for that. But are you comfortable with someone having that kind of access? Because you, at some point down the road, it will no longer become voluntary. Understand, in this country, we've already passed the Real ID Act, which fortunately a lot of states have said no to, Pennsylvania being one of them. But secretly, we know that it's starting to happen. They're putting identifiers in every driver's license. They're nationalizing every driver's license, and some even do have RFID chips in them so that we can follow you, so that we know where everyone is. And that's where the libertarian in me pops out. Because I don't want anyone, government, for-profit corporation, or anyone having that kind of control, that kind of influence, or that kind of ability at all. So it always amazes me that the people who are the most anti-government are the ones who don't seem to have a problem with the for-profit corporation owning their information. But dead, according to Scalia, our Constitution. Quick break, right back after this.
A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of a lucky one. I announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat, it is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m., I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
This Valentine's Day, give your special someone a beautiful Swarovski crystal heart made by women who have survived war in South Sudan. These stunning items are available in small, medium, and large sizes and come in crystal, red, pink, and other beautiful colors. And the best part? They're yours starting at just $25 plus shipping. To order yours today, go to goatsfortheoldgoat.com and click on shop. Again, that's goatsfortheoldgoat.com and click on shop.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
When does the age of Aquarius begin? And what is the age of Aquarius?
The age of Aquarius isn't part of astronomy. It's an astrological age, which occurs because of a real motion of Earth known as the precession of the equinoxes. The cycle of precession lasts 25,800 years. There are 12 constellations in the zodiac.
So roughly every 2,150 years, the sun's position at the time of the March equinox moves in front of a new zodiac constellation. The age of Aquarius is said to begin when the equinox point moves out of Pisces and into the constellation Aquarius.
But there's no definitive answer as to when that will be. From an astronomical point of view, the International Astronomical Union created official constellation boundaries as recently as 1930. Based on those boundaries, the March equinox will cross over into the constellation Aquarius in the year 2597.
Meanwhile, Nicholas Campion at the University of Wales has studied astrologers' ideas about when we enter the age of Aquarius. They range from the year 1447 AD to the year 3597 AD. So, even among astrologers, there's no consensus as to when the age of Aquarius begins.
For more, search on Aquarius at earthsky.org. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Mike Brennan. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee, in a right-to-work state, at a low cost, with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? It's time to let these people learn the lesson the hard way.
That quote's a couple years old, and, you know, every time I hear Zach Womp say that, every time it pops up, it makes me think, you know, at least they're open about it. They're honest. The whole idea, the whole point behind all of their agenda, the right to work for all that, the whole no rights at work nonsense, it's all about lower wages, less health care, less pensions. It's all about creating a business-friendly environment that is, well, friendly for business, but desperation nation for you and me. And you know what we've been talking about all around the country, you're seeing these paycheck fairness bills popping up, and you're seeing all of this attacks on workers' rights, and with really a lot of very nice language, very flowery, euphemistic kind of language. Like, who could possibly be against paycheck fairness? But when you get right down to it, what exactly does it do? Well, it screws the worker pretty badly. Look at what's going on in Kansas. Yesterday, they came out with their euphemistically paycheck fairness bill. And today, another one being introduced, as I understand, that would understand Kansas is a right to work for less state already. Now what they want to do is they want to do away with public sector collective bargaining altogether. And boy, the right wing is all tingly in the panties over this one, because if they can get that, mission accomplished. They can break that Bush banner out. I can, you know, the little package and everything. It'd be just like back then, which is why I've asked Bruce Hallman, senior labor relations specialist at the Kansas Organization of State Employees, to come talk to us. Bruce, thanks for taking time for me.
Good evening.
You know, I look at this and, you know, doing away with this sounds very much like what happened in Wisconsin, trying to steal collective bargaining rights away. It's not bad enough that it's a right to work state already, but you want to completely take collective bargaining rights away entirely.
You're absolutely correct, Rick. In fact, you talked about the flowery language.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to this language that they come up with is quite interesting, in that, you know, it sounds nice, like right to work sounds semi reasonable. It sounds like, oh, I have the right. I have the right to work. But when you really get down to it, does it have anything to do with anyone having any rights or there being any work attached to it? And the answer is obviously no. The only right there is that you're going to end up getting screwed and you're end up going to not being able to collectively bargain and get better wages, better hours, better conditions, better benefits. That's the whole point. And, you know, I look at this, Bruce, and I wonder, you know, as you go through this attack on collective bargaining again in Kansas, what's this going to take? I understand they're going to try and amend your Constitution.
Well, they're trying to do that. And, you know, Rick, you mentioned flowery language. The first part of this bill, House Bill 2123, shall be known and may be cited as the Public Employee Freedom Act.
Yeah.
Now, that sounds just wonderful. But there is no freedom involved.
Well, there is freedom. There's the freedom to starve. There's the freedom to work for free. There's the freedom to, you know, to not have health care, and the freedom to not have a pension. There's a lot of freedom there.
Well, I understand that. It's not, you know, at what cost, though? At what cost to the employee? You know, these people in Kansas, these state workers, are the lowest paid in this region. They've not had any kind of real pay increases in over 9 years. There have been a couple free, what they want to call market rate adjustments. But no annual pay raises, no biannual pay raises, no nothing for over 9 years.
And that's insane to me.
You know, when somebody hires on today, they're making exactly what somebody hired on 10 years ago.
So why do the people put up with it? I mean, at some point, do the citizens of Kansas not realize that that by allowing that segment of the workforce to be pushed down, it's pulling everyone down with them?
I don't know what the answer is, Rick. I've talked to these people. I've been involved in this kind of work for years and years and years. They're just happy to have a job.
So explain to me how this is going to. Yeah, explain to me how this is going to go through your process. They're going to try and add it to your Constitution.
Well, this will be a state law. Is what this is going to be. What they're trying to add to the Constitution is something else altogether different. This here will, as it says in the bill, an employer and employee should be able to. Should be free to contract on their own terms, and mandatory collective bargaining laws violate this freedom. But very few employees know how to go into their employer and say, I'd like to have this, I'd like to have that. And they don't have the background normally.
Well, that's the point.
They don't have the expertise, and they don't know what to ask for.
Well, that's the point. We want desperation. We want people, and what they really want is they want to be able to bring in outside, and I see this guest worker thing being part of this as well. They want people exploitable enough that'll work for pennies, so it pulls all of us down even further. And, you know, I listen to you say that, and I think of all of my anti-government right-wing friends who say, I don't want the government involved in my life. Well, explain to me why we should be allowing the government to dictate what contract an employee and their employer can make.
I've never figured that out myself. You know, the right wing and the far right wing do not want any sort of government intrusion, and yet they want to intrude upon everybody else. As long as it does not affect me, it's okay. But you know, we will intrude on the populace, but not me.
Yeah, because I see what's going on in Kansas, and I saw what was going on in Wisconsin and Ohio and Michigan, and all of these well-orchestrated, well-funded corporate attacks of workers all around the country. I say, you know what, folks, here in Pennsylvania, you're next. We're all in the shark tank, and eventually we're going to be flavor of the month. You know, before it was Wisconsin, it was Ohio, it's Michigan, now Kansas. Hey, we're still in the shark tank.
Well, and we can look a little south here in Kansas to Wichita. And look at the brothers down there, and there are two organizations. You've got Americans for Prosperity and ALEC,
In fact, the Kansas legislators right now are trying to modify their session so that they can attend a an ALEC function in May. They're going into a long recess so they can make their little party with ALEC.
Jeez, oh man. And of course, collect, reap the benefits when they get to their little party. And the problem I have with this is, you know, for the longest time, nobody had a clue of who ALEC was, and they flew under the radar. And you look at all of the nastiness and all of the, well, all of the bidding that they've done for the wealth class, and I go, who's out there fighting for the little guy? It's the people that are, that ALEC and the wealth class are trying to destroy right now.
Right. It all has to go to the top. You know, nothing stays at the bottom. And, you know, the more they can have, the happier they are.
But don't you think at some point they have to realize that by, you know, as bad as Henry Ford was and the stories I've heard about him, he was basically a tyrant, but even he got the fact that, you know, workers had to make a reasonable living to buy his product.
Right, absolutely. That was one of his first rules after they tried to organize was, you know, pay him more so they, you know, so I'll stay in business. These people don't understand that. I don't know what their thought process is. They want it all. And they want everybody else to have nothing.
Now, I mean, it's a power trip is the way I look at it. And I see all of this attack on labor. I see all of this attack on working people as very just a Machiavellian policy. You know, the Republicans and the right view organized labor and workers as constituents of the Democrats. And I wouldn't even say that they really are. It's just the last. It's just the last area where workers have any ability to enact policy or make their lives better because, look, the right has been just so toxic, and the policies that they have pushed have been so bad that, you know, workers have been left nowhere else to go but the Democrats at this point.
Right, and I'm a child of the 50s, I guess you would say. I remember when Republicans were actually for labor. You know, you had the young Republicans, and they had meetings, and they came to union meetings. My dad was a Teamster. And you'd see Republicans speaking up there at the podium.
Yeah, I mean,
supporting us.
Yeah, I go back and you think about it, you brought up the 50s and Dwight Eisenhower, who had written to his brother back in 1952, should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you wouldn't hear of that party again in our political history. He did say there's a tiny splinter group, of course, that believes you can do these things among them. Some Texas oil millionaires, an occasional politician or businessman. Their numbers are negligible, and they are stupid. And I've been saying for some time, stupid is running the Republican Party right now.
And it's day by day by day, it just seems to get worse. You see these outrageous comments across the spectrum. And it's just, where do these people come from? How do they think this way? They don't like labor. They don't like women. They don't like children. They don't like anybody.
Well, I would argue that it's, you know, it's the wealth class that has created these people. They've funded, you know, all of this outreach. And you go back and you read the Powell memo back in 71 where they're going to take the country in a conservative pro-business direction. And you look at how they've saturated our media. You look at the books that get written, the professors that they've put in. You know, I go back to the Koch brothers who funded, Florida State University with $2 million a year so that they could have veto power of any economics professor in their department. That's real power, Bruce.
Absolutely. I was born and raised in a town, Terre Haute, Indiana. On a field trip in sixth grade, if I remember correctly, we went to the home of Eugene V. Debs. We were taught labor in school. It doesn't happen anymore.
No, they've actually, not only have they washed labor's history completely out of the textbooks, they've even rewritten it to the point to where those people were wrong and business, the benevolent corporations were somehow wronged in all of this.
Absolutely. If it wasn't for labor, then, you know, we would be happier. Well, somebody has to do the work, Rick. I mean, somebody has to do it.
So what do we tell folks here? I mean, because I understand, and I know my listeners get it, that what you're going through there in Kansas is coming here. The bills are all here. Alec has made sure that they've passed them all around. The model legislation is out there. I know you guys are fighting it back. You know, what are you guys doing? What should we be doing here to prepare for it?
Well, and it's like I try to tell the state employees, you know, and this organization, since its inception, they have not been Democrat or Republican. It's been whoever supports the state workers. And we consistently tell them to look at the legislators' record, see how they voted for you, see what they've done for you, and or not, and then make your decision and cast your ballot in that way. But I don't know what the problem is, but they keep voting against their own self-interest. I mean, you hear state employees, I don't want government on my back. Do they not realize that they are part of government?
That's almost as good as the guy on Medicare saying, keep your government hands off my health care.
I don't know what the answer is, Rick. We need all the help we can get. We put the message out daily, sometimes hourly. I constantly talk to employees. I know Mike Marvin does. The organizers we have on staff, they are consistently talking to these employees. We send out email alerts, blast emails all across the state about what's going on. As soon as we get an inkling of what's going on, we let the employees know. You know, they need to get on their cell phones. They need to get on their home phones. They need to get on their email while they're not at work. And tell these legislators, quit picking on us.
Yeah, we're not the whipping boy. And, you know, for me, I think the answer is going back to the roots of labor, organizing, getting people into the streets, building coalitions, and getting people into the streets. That's where it has to be fought. And I got to be honest, the business community, the wealth class, they've done a very effective, very good job of keeping people apart. You see all of the unemployment offices here in Pennsylvania, gone. We do all our unemployment over the phone. The welfare offices, gone. Any place where working people or poor people would come together, those places have been disappeared. And what they've done effectively is they've put poor working class people, they've pushed those people into the periphery where nobody sees them.
Right. The social service agency here, which is now called the Department for Children and Families, mainly you have to get on the phone, you have to get on the computer. They're going to this team concept, where you're not assigned a social worker. Unemployment the same way. You have to call. If you do take the chance to go into the office, nobody in there can give you an answer. Yep. And that's the way it's been designed now. You know, keep the people outside. Make them use the phone. Make them use a computer. Make them wait. And, you know, eventually they'll just get tired, go away, and bother somebody else, I guess.
And then get the message that government is bad and we need to privatize,
right.
Which is what we're in the middle of right now. And look, it always amazes me, the people who tell me that they despise government and they don't believe in government are the ones who want to run it. And then when it fails, we're surprised that it failed. Of course it failed.
Well, and I've told state employees for years, you know, they're their own worst enemy because they don't tell anybody how important what they do is. You know, the guys at KDOT, they're massing out tonight. There's supposed to be some kind of a snow event coming in. And I talked to one of my stewards. He's in bed right now waiting to be called out at midnight. But nobody knows it. And they don't talk about it because, well, that's just my job.
Well, that's something labor has to communicate a lot better, not only their history, but also what they do for the community and for society as a whole, which is why I'm glad you took some time and talked to us tonight. I wish you nothing but the best in your fight there in Kansas, because if you can stop it there, maybe you stop it there and it doesn't come here. So I appreciate it, Bruce.
No problem, Rick, and I'm glad that you had us on your forum here today.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much, Bruce Heilman, Senior Labor Relations Specialist with the Kansas Organization of State Employees. Quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Smith Show.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy. The Rick Smith Show.
That's the Republican mantra. That's the business class mantra. We want it all. We want it now. And we definitely don't want anyone standing in our way. And I look at, you know, the reason that I think it's important that we talk about what goes on in Kansas and in Virginia and Wisconsin and all of these other places where these attacks on workers' rights are happening in real time is because, look, it's here. It is, as Scarnati said today in his press conference, this right-to-work legislation is always here. There's always someone putting it forth. It's just now the big money is looking at Pennsylvania going, hey, look what happened in Michigan. We pour a bunch of money in here. You know, maybe all of that money we've been wasting in Pennsylvania to keep it in the public, maybe it's going to pay off. And then we can steal back those wages and those benefits. And you heard what the guy said there in 9 years, no raise. That's what right-to-work legislation does. That what we've been talking about, giving in to what they want, which is absolute power and control, means, like Zach Wamp said, less wages, less benefits. I don't know how much simpler it can be. Once you destroy collective bargaining, once you destroy the right to collective bargaining,
the only right you're left with, call it whatever you want, is the right to work for less money, the right to work for less benefits, and the right to work in less safe conditions. It's that simple. It doesn't get any more complicated than that. And you have people like WOMP who will tell you that. You got to give the people credit. At least they're honest. They're on the payroll of some big corporation. They're on the payroll of the billionaire class. They're not ashamed of it. They've chosen sides. The question is you as a working person, this goes back to the old labor song, which side are you on? We know where the Zach Womps are. We know where a lot of our politicians are. We know where Tom Corbett is. We know which side they're on. Pretty simple to figure that out. Question is which side are we on? And what the wealth class has done, the business community has done so masterfully. Because they understand marketing and advertising. They understand the need to be in your ear constantly. What they figured out is if they can keep us divided and pointing fingers at, wow, you know, those workers over there got pensions. And it's those unions that got them for them. They're the problem. Instead of saying, well, wait a second. They got pensions. Mine got stolen. How do we fix that? And look, I understand, the 80s and 90s, our government allowed corporations to steal pensions from workers all across this country, millions of people, because we wanted to be business friendly. So we've got these bankruptcy laws that say, well, you know what? Yeah, go ahead. Saddle the companies with huge amounts of debt, massive debt. Run them through bankruptcy so that when they come out on the other side, they're squeaky clean. They have no pension obligations. They have no contract problems. All that's gone. And the reason the right in the business community is so infuriated with Obama, the reason they're so angry with Obama over what happened in Detroit with the Big Three, they didn't steal their pensions. You heard Romney say it during the campaign. I would have put them through bankruptcy, controlled bankruptcy, so that we could steal their pensions, void those contracts, cut their wages. For me, I think if a company goes through bankruptcy, the pension obligation to the workers should be right there at the top of the things that get paid first, before the CEO, before the executives, before the stockholders, the workers. And do you want to see stockholders with some motive to keep the company on the straight and narrow? I'll bet you that would have a lot to do with it. Problem is what we've done is we've taken risk out of investing. Because we make sure that they get something back, right? Which is why, again, why they're angry over the GM thing and over Chrysler. Simple stuff. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Going to take a quick break. Right back with hour three of the program. Stick around.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Nissan workers struggling to form a union at the automaker's Canton, Mississippi plant got support Tuesday from civil rights leaders, actor Danny Glover, as well as student and community activists. The workers want Nissan to be neutral and allow workers a fair election to decide whether or not to be represented by the United Auto Workers. Derek Johnson, president of Mississippi's NAACP, supports a union for these Nissan workers.
When workers go to work on Monday, they don't know whether they're going to work a four-hour day or 12-hour day. They have no idea whether it's going to be a 4-day week or a 7-day week. They are pretty much held captive until the plant decides they can come and go.
Johnson says labor's struggle is a civil rights struggle for justice, and this Mississippi Nissan Workers Union organizing effort has national implications.
We see this as a civil rights issue. We see this as a national movement. We understand that what happens in the South as it relates to organized labor could make the difference of whether or not organized labor exists in this country, because it is the new battleground where the Midwest and the Northeastern states had a long, hard fight to organize. And as a result of that, you had individuals across racial lines, across gender, who were able to move up into the middle class. But in the South, where we have right-to-work states, where we have low union density, we see this as our opportunity to raise up the South, create a new paradigm, and allow workers to truly appreciate the benefit of their labor and increase the quality of their life.
A new Center for Economic and Policy Research paper says the International Monetary Fund has been pushing for lower spending, shrinking government, and cutting social programs in European Union member countries, often regardless of a country's specific economic circumstances. The center says these austerity policies, including public pension and health care cuts and raising the retirement ages, can worsen the economic recession confronting Europe. The Center for Disease Control is touting the release of a new study on infections at U.S. biological laboratories as a success story. Jesse Russell reports.
Between 2004 and 2010, only 11 workers at U.S. biological laboratories were infected with dangerous pathogens. The labs employ around 10,000 workers each year, making the infection rate 1.6 in 10,000. The reporting requirement was made by Congress after 5 people were killed by anthrax in 2001. Those deaths were allegedly from letters sent by a researcher at an Army lab in Maryland. The report additionally found that between 2004 and 2010, there were 0 reported thefts and only 1 lost pathogen. That lost pathogen was attributed to an error by a commercial carrier.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So, you know, we hear an awful lot about, well, the founders this. And like I said earlier, Scalia says the Constitution's dead, dead, dead. He doesn't believe in the concept of a living, breathing Constitution. To him, it's just words on a page. To me, it's much more than that. And you hear a lot about what the original intent was, you know, what the founders believed. And a lot of it's misquoted. A lot of it's, oh, we took little pieces of this or that. The question is, what did the founders really believe? What were their thoughts? And today is Thomas Paine's birthday, which is why we have asked somebody I consider to be the expert on Thomas Paine. Harvey Kay has written the book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. Harvey Kay is a professor at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Harvey, thanks for taking time for me.
Sorry, there was a beep there, but whatever you said, I'm here, and I'm happy to be here.
I appreciate you taking the time. You know, today, the birthday of Thomas Paine. You know, one of the questions I wanted to ask is, you see all of this talk about the original intent, the founders. You know, what do you think some of the biggest distortions about Thomas Paine have been in your eyes?
Well, needless to say, Thomas, the ruling classes in American history have had very little to do with Thomas Paine's memory. Thomas Paine envisioned an America that was going to be not only independent of Britain, it was also going to be a democratic republic. And when he wrote not for the ruling class's interest, not for the propertied folk. He wrote for working people. So I think what's happened over time is that when Paine is recalled in American history, and it hasn't been often enough, we talk about him as if, you know, he was the guy who wrote the pamphlet that called for independence. And we forget that, in fact, he was the guy who wrote the pamphlet that actually endowed Americans with a sense that we had a very special place in history to make something never before seen, and that was a democratic republic. So I think when we think about the founders, instead of just sort of thinking about folks up on a pedestal, or we ought to be thinking about Payne, the radical Democrat who inspired us to democratic possibilities.
That's an interesting. That's an excellent way of putting it. You know, I listen to a lot of this rhetoric thrown back and forth, and you would think that all of the founders, Payne included, were these rabid right wingers who envisioned a corporatocracy and a meritocracy and all of this.
Yeah, they like to tell us that the founders envisioned, you know, small government, a sacredness of property. But if you read Thomas Paine from start to finish, say starting with Common Sense, the revolutionary pamphlet, he wrote that in order to inspire, as I said, democratic action. And if you continue to go through his writings, you come to works like Rights of Man and Agrarian Justice, in which he actually lays out a vision for what we would call social democracy, a social security system, taxing the rich in order to provide for the needs of the elderly and provide starting up funds for young people. I mean, the founders were not these right-wing libertarian types who opposed any kind of government action, at least in the case of Paine, and I could probably find others, but no one more so than Paine. The idea was to make an America democratic, and where public action was necessary, pursue it.
What do you think someone like Paine would, if he were alive today and looked at what has happened over the years, what do you think he would see?
What would he see?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, Paine, just so you know, when Paine came to America, he was absolutely impressed by America's possibilities. And he was very much moved by the fact that Americans were already in a state of rebellion. So he had great expectations, both in terms of a strong and rich country, but also a people that were prepared to defend their rights and advance democracy at home. So when if he came back today and he looked around, he'd surely be impressed by the wealth that's been accumulated, but he'd be shocked at the way in which the wealth that's been accumulated has been accumulated in the hands of a very limited upper class.
I mean, because, you know, that's my take on it as well. You know, you look at all of this and you've seen this massive concentration of wealth into the hands of the few, and you could look at what we fought the revolution to get away from is almost what we've created.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we shouldn't forget that in every generation there have been Americans who've rediscovered Thomas Paine's arguments. And over again we've seen these kind of radical democratic struggles from the free thinkers and the abolitionists and the early feminists through to the populists and the socialists. You know, the labor movement itself was deeply inspired by Paine's arguments. So we shouldn't see, you know, 200 and more years of things going wrong. We've got to remember that within us, there still beats this radical democratic heart, and Paine would call on us to remember who we are and to act upon it. You know, it's interesting, since we've just come off of an inauguration, to know that in 2008, when Obama was inaugurated, he quoted Thomas Paine at his inauguration, but he didn't cite Thomas Paine's name, which worried me a bit. And though we've seen some very progressive developments, we've seen far more disappointments and far more sort of wealth and power being handed over to those who already have wealth and power. Now, this time around, in 2013, at an inauguration, we had a very progressive-sounding speech, no mention of Thomas Paine, but similarly, no mention of the labor movement. So, I mean, what Paine would say, and he'd line up with working people, is, you know, don't wait on the elites to make things happen. Get yourselves going, get yourselves organized, and start making history.
Yeah, I mean, that's where my thought was going with that. I mean, the reality is we can't, and I think that was a big flaw in 2009, that people who got Obama elected thought, okay, we won. We got the Democrats in control. They're going to take care of everything. We can go back to our lives and go back to, you know, American Idol and Cheetos or whatever
right.
We do. And,
right.
And I think you're right. What needs to happen is, and I think Paine would be in line with it, you need to get out in the streets. We need to get organized. We need to be fighting the battles for ourselves.
Yeah, well, you know, what's fascinating is there's no doubt that Obama tapped into an American spirit. You know, he actually had, especially young people, believing in yes, we can. But the yes, we can was not followed up with now we will do it.
Right.
You know, he sort of, once again, it became an inside the beltway kind of politics with lobbyists present, with power and wealth speaking to politicians much more effectively than the people. But on the other hand, we can't sit back and merely whine and moan and say, well, my God, Obama failed us. We've got to make things happen. I mean, those of us in the labor movement especially, we've got our backs to the wall. I mean, it's gotten so bad, as I said, that a president of the United States who was placed in office by working people going out and you know, campaigning door to door. I mean, we put him in office, and now what have we got? We've got, you know, we find ourselves ignored in the inaugural address. So, my God, we've got a struggle ahead of us.
Yeah, I mean, but one, I do believe that we're able, and a lot of people are willing to fight. And I go back to, you know, people like Payne and, you know, to the founders in general. I don't think that they envisioned the country that we've become of really the two Americas.
No, definitely did not envision this. I mean, again, if you go, I mean, I would urge those people who can take the time to get themselves a copy of Thomas Paine's Common Sense. It started out as a pamphlet of 50 pages. And it became a bestseller. I mean, it sold 120,000 copies within the course of several months. And in the course of the revolution, 500,000 copies. I mean, today that would make it probably one of the greatest bestsellers in American history. And in it, Paine talks to us like he's our friend. And he's telling us, look, you've got incredible possibilities. We have incredible possibilities here in America, but we can't leave it to kings and aristocrats, for that matter. We can't leave it to the kings on Wall Street and the aristocrats alongside of them.
What do you think he would think of Scalia's comment that the Constitution is dead?
Well, I mean, it's interesting to note that in Thomas Paine's pamphlet, Common Sense, he lays out an original democratic vision of a Constitution. He didn't say that this was the one we should adopt, but he said, let me get things going. And one of the things that he emphasized, really emphatically, was the idea of building into the Constitution a Bill of Rights. And probably the greatest legacy of the Constitution is that Bill of Rights. And I don't see how they're dead. And, you know, the other thing about Paine is that he over and over again argued that the way in which you keep a Constitution alive is you don't leave it to the judges to make decisions. You organize, you mobilize, and you amend the Constitution where needed. I mean, it's hard to imagine Paine ever having lined up with the likes of a Scalia.
Yeah, I mean, but I see a lot of right wingers who, you know, they love the quotes.
Oh, you know, well, in fact, I mean, it's amazing to me that for 200 years, conservatives would have nothing to do with Thomas Paine. And then the guy who tried to lay claim to Thomas Paine for the right wingers was Reagan. Reagan knew that Paine's words would speak to Americans. And what he made it a point of doing was poaching the words of Paine that would lead to a right-wing kind of political ideology. So the words he liked to quote had to do with government as a necessary evil, failing to consider that that was Paine's arguments about a kingly government, not his arguments about a democratic government. Reagan said, we have it in our power to start the world over again, which were Paine's words. But what Paine had in mind was making a more democratic, a more egalitarian social, political and social order, not one in which the only folks who get liberated are the ones who have the capital to invest and take advantage of the rest of us. And by the way, right-wingers from Glenn Beck to Sarah Palin have tried their best in the last several years to basically lay claim to a Thomas Paine who never even existed outside of their own imagination.
No, but here again, it's the rewriting of history, and you brought up Glenn Beck. I loved his story about George Washington. In fact, he actually told a story of what Washington's horse was thinking. I mean, that's how far we've gone. That's how far they've gone with the liberties of history.
Well, I guess one end of the horse might have a better idea about what the other end of the horse has to say than you or I.
But no, he had a whole dialogue about what the horse was thinking and breathing. And but again, it's what they've done to our history.
Yeah, no. As a historian, I mean, one of the causes that I've pursued for the past 30 years is the idea of reappropriating our progressive history in America. I mean, this is a nation that has the most radical democratic history in the world. In fact, you know what? I mean, we have President's Day coming up. Think about it this way. Go to Washington, D.C., and imagine yourself walking on the National Mall. Consider the fact that we have a monument to a revolutionary general. We have a temple, the Jefferson Memorial, a celebration of one of the most radical democratic thinkers of his day. We have the Lincoln Memorial, a monument basically to an emancipator and a man who sided repeatedly with working people. And then we have the FDR Memorial, which is this great testament to social democracy in America. And yet somehow or other, that kind of history gets marginalized.
Well, that's because that's Washington. That's those liberals.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you can go from the Washington Monument to the Jefferson Memorial to the Lincoln Memorial to the FDR Memorial, and you've got a radical, democratic, and progressive history. The only thing missing there is a statue to Thomas Paine.
And how do we get that?
Well, you know, back in the early 1990s, there was the Senate actually passed a resolution endorsing the idea, but there were conservatives in Washington, there were conservatives and liberals in Washington who hesitated to push it and realize it. And now, of course, we're going to get a monument to Eisenhower probably, and then a monument to John Adams, which tells you something about the direction of historical thinking.
Yeah, and wow.
Although, actually, when I say Eisenhower, I mean, as conservative as he was, he comes out a liberal compared to what we've seen the last 30 years.
Oh, a flaming liberal of what,
yeah,
what's happening.
Yeah, right.
So,
right.
You know, in thinking about today being the birthday of Thomas Paine, what message would you want people, you know, folks who may not have read any of the books, but have heard some of the, you know, some of the distortions, some of the things, what do you want them to take away?
I want them to take away the fact that the first and most important founder, Thomas Paine, the man who envisioned an independent and democratic America, still speaks to us today. I mean, we know, we can see, we saw it in 2008 in the elections, we saw it in 2012. Americans are more progressive than the politicians representing them in Washington. And the only way that we're going to see change is if we start making noise. I mean, not too many weeks ago, I said in the wake of the election, well, now it's time, and I did it as an open letter to Trump, good, now it's time to march on Washington for jobs and freedom. Now's not the time to say, well, we won, let's wait to see what happens. Now's the time, and we learned this in 2009, to make sure that working people's voices are heard. I mean, you know, again, we in the labor movement, we have our backs to the wall, and we're going to have to start getting more aggressive about it.
I'm with you, and I think it was a lesson from our past. I mean, FDR, the story goes, and maybe you would know better than I, but the story goes is some labor leaders came and said, we want this, this, and this, and FDR goes, okay, now get out there and make people push me into doing it.
Yeah, it's a great story, isn't it? These reformers, they could have been civil rights people, they could have been labor leaders. The point was they were probably both. And they came to Washington exactly as you said, and he looked at them and said, look, I agree with you. Now make me do it, which was an invitation to basically mobilize people. And by the way, the book I'm finishing right now in the writing, I'll be done by March 1st, is titled Fighting for the Four Freedoms. What really made Franklin Roosevelt and the Greatest Generation great? And basically, it's that kind of dynamic between president and people, a dynamic that we've not seen since 1945. It's a dynamic we need to see again.
Absolutely.
And it's not going to be the folks in Washington who instigated it. It's going to be folks coming out of Washington. Our labor leaders are going to have to start making that call.
Yeah, and it wasn't people in Washington who did all those things. It was my grandfather's generation who came back from fighting World War II, who went to the shop floor and fought for better wages.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. In fact, you know, if you've got a moment, I can tell you that I've looked closely at these speeches of Obama regarding his grandfather in the Greatest Generation. And he speaks as if it had to do only with the values that these folks brought back from the war in terms of making the middle-class nation of the 1950s and 60s. Well, no, it wasn't. It had to do with the fact that they were willing to march and demand. Do you know, it's interesting, we mentioned Eisenhower before. Eisenhower had to be more liberal in office than he ever wanted to be, because he knew well from his time as a general and later running for office that Americans believed in those four freedoms, freedom of speech, freedom of worship, and freedom from want and freedom from fear. He said, by the way, in 1954, he said to his press secretary in a private conversation, he said, you know, we've got these congressional elections coming up. We have to convince Americans that we have a liberal program. And then his brother, Edgar Eisenhower, who was his conservative brother, wrote to him and said, well, when are you going to start turning back the clock? When are we going to start getting rid of all this New Deal stuff? And Eisenhower wrote back to his brother and said, any party that tries to do away with the New Deal, labor law reform, you name it, of that sort, will never be heard from again in this country. Well, times have changed a lot, and somewhere along the line, we lost touch with who we are.
Well, let me finish that for you. He said there are a few people, Texas oil millionaires, occasional politician. Their numbers are negligible, and they're stupid. And I've been saying for the longest time, stupid is running the Republican Party and a good number of the Democrats as well.
Yeah, I am absolutely with you on that. Absolutely with you.
Well, when the book comes out, we'd love to have you back. I'm looking forward to it, Harvey. I appreciate the time.
Thank you. You're doing great work. Somebody's got to have labor's voice out there, and I know you're doing it.
Thanks so much. Harvey Kay, professor at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, also the author of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. On today, Thomas Paine's birthday. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
This Valentine's Day, give your special someone a beautiful Swarovski crystal heart made by women who have survived war in South Sudan. These stunning items are available in small, medium, and large sizes and come in crystal, red, pink, and other beautiful colors. And the best part? They're yours starting at just $25 plus shipping. To order yours today, go to goatsfortheoldgoat.com and click on shop. Again, that's goatsfortheoldgoat.com and click on shop.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
What a satisfying sight it would have been for the public to see Lloyd Blankfein, Jamie Dimon, and other high-rolling Wall Street banksters in handcuffs for having illegally foreclosed on the homes of hundreds of thousands of American families. But no, instead of the kingpins of finance finally having to take responsibility for evicting so many people and wrecking the nation's housing market, not a single one has even been pursued by the law. Rather, federal regulators have negotiated a secret deal with Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and nine other mortgage lending giants, letting banks pay $10 billion in penalties to end the case against them. The lesson here is clear. If your crime is vast enough, forget doing time. You don't even personally pay the fine. You just unleash your mad dog lawyers to cut a deal, shifting the cost of your felonious profiteering scheme onto your bank shareholders. Letting the chief schemers deflect responsibility also has zero deterrent effect on their future scheming, and it destroys public trust in the notion of equal justice for all. It's not fair, we shout in exasperation. But the big shots out back, fair? That's where you take your pig to win a blue ribbon. This is Wall Street, baby. Grab all you can. So they're still there, still scheming, profiting, and grinning. In the same week that Goldman Sachs agreed to pay a fine for its illicit treatment of homeowners, it announced that CEO Lloyd Blankfein was awarded some $19 million in pay, including a $6 million bonus. Likewise, J.P. Morgan agreed to a sweetheart settlement for its mortgage malfeasance. Then, a week later, it delivered an $11.5 million paycheck to its chief, Jamie Dimon. This is Jim Hightower saying, anyone who says crime doesn't pay simply is not paying attention to Wall Street.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not close. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children.
Think about that statement. I mean, you know, all of the money that he's saying we're spending on defense, it's, you know, stealing from, you know, our scientists, our laborers, our children, our future. And you look at this whole sequester thing. And I don't know if you saw it on Sunday. Paul Ryan was on Meet the Depressed. And he said, look, you know, the sequester cuts are going to happen. Because they've set up this system that, and masterfully, I mean, you got to give the Republicans credit. They set up this system where down the line they could use it as another hostage situation, and they're going to. They don't want the $1.2 trillion in automatic spending cuts to the Pentagon and to other government agencies. They don't want that because it's gonna cause real pain for people, and someone's going to be blamed. But they think they're going to be able to point the finger at Obama because what they've come out and said is, well, look, we've got a plan. We wouldn't hurt you middle-class people. We've got a plan. We're going to cut those people. We're going to cut all those food stamps, and we're going to slash Medicaid, and we're going to eliminate the funding for Obamacare. And, oh, by the way, we're going to cut some funding to disaster relief because that's the Republican plan. And it blows my mind that you look at the money that is supposed to be going to the victims of Hurricane Sandy. 31 of them in the Senate, 31 Republicans opposed it after supporting disaster aid for themselves. I mean, and you think of Pat Toomey. He had gone and asked for disaster relief money for Hurricane Sandy before it even hit. He had his hand out saying, I want to bring the poor home to my state, which we demand of our senators and our congressmen. But then why are you against it? So he's got his hand out saying, I need this for my constituents, but we're not going to pay for it. And you go down the list, all Republicans. All of these people who they're happy, and a lot of them Southern Republicans who have year after year after year disaster relief. And yet, as part of the sequester that Ryan is telling us is going to happen, part of the way to avoid it is where we're going to have to cut that disaster. It just blows my mind. What I find interesting, though, is he said that had he been elected Vice President Romney, these sequester cuts would not have happened. And then my question is, well, why do they have to happen now? And I look at Ryan, and I'm telling you, As sure as the sun will come up tomorrow, that here is a guy who is chafed. Here's a bitter little, it's another B word that goes with that, who is going to be a thorn, who is going to be the one who poison pills, obstructs, delays, and everything he can do simply to make the black guy in the White House look bad. Country be damned. Jobs be damned, all of that. And I go back and I think about, you know, all of the hostage situations that the right has created. And understand, the vast majority of this sequester thing, another manufactured crisis. And it blows my mind that we, and I guess, you know, I'm not quite sure how to put it. Explain to me, you know, when there's a crisis is something that's kind of unavoidable, right? You know, there's a natural disaster, and you have, you know, a hurricane wipes away half a city. There's a crisis there. You have to deal with it. Why is it that when we create an environment that we completely have control over, like the debt ceiling or the fiscal cliff, or this sequester or anything. We've created this. We made this up. We birthed this out of whole cloth. Here it is. We have made this situation, of which we completely and totally have the control to unmake. And yet our media continues to say, oh, there's this grand crisis, the fiscal cliff, the debt ceiling crisis, the sequester hall, it's the end of the civilization, it's all of this. Manufactured crisis. Making this stuff up. So I see this headline over at the Hill. U.S. debt headed towards 200% of GDP even after fiscal cliff deal. And anybody who just reads the like most people do, they just browse on the news, see that headline, read maybe the first paragraph. You go, country's in trouble. Even with the fiscal cliff fix, oh, we're in big trouble. It's all 200% of GDP. Oh my goodness, we're headed there. And I actually know what the number is. We were at 69. We're up around 72% of GDP right now, which is actually a pretty decent debt ratio. I mean, I don't know. Most of my friends are well beyond that. You think about your home, your car loan, all your credit cards. Think about all your bills. Think about your GDP. You make maybe $50,000 a year. Got a $200,000 home loan. Uh-oh. We're way the hell over 400% of our GDP, right? Obviously, just in our home for a lot of folks. But don't think about that. So you go and you read the story. And it turns out that it's a report from this Peter G. Peterson Foundation, one of these right-wing think tank kind of groups, but more than just right-wing. Very anti-government, very pro-big business. So, as much as the conservative label might apply, the pro-big business, the corporatist label really applies in my view. So they put this out saying, well, in the year 2040, by 2040 we'll be at 200% of GDP. And I'm going, 2040, that's kind of a long reach, don't you think? Understand, their view is if nothing changes, if we continue to have the pathetic growth and the gridlock and all of the things, the obstruction and all of the things that have gone on, if we continue on the path that we're on now, yes, 200% by some have said 2040, some have said further down the road. And you know what? When you're dealing with those kind of variables, you might as well just say we're going to be at 1,000,000% of GDP by the year 3000. You might as well. Because look, this year, there's some expectation that the economy is going to pick up. A lot of economists are saying they're guardedly optimistic that, you know what, you're going to get a jobs bill. Look, here in Pennsylvania, you've actually got a state senator saying transportation is important. Governor's actually saying we might actually consider something on transportation, something we should have done 2 years ago, but they're considering it now. Something they should have done 2 years ago, now going to get around to it, maybe considering that an election is coming up in another 2 years. That's going to put people back to work on the national level. Going to probably see a transportation bill. Going to put people back to work. Good thing. So all of these doomsday projections are just that. They're meant to go, oh, we got something to do. It's like the $41 billion pension number. That's saying that there's no money in the pension fund right now and everybody leaves today and takes their money out. That's what that is. And it's meant to make us look like dolts. We're too stupid to realize what they're talking about. Oh, what? $41 billion? That's a lot of money. And it is. If there were no money in the account and everyone left today. But as things turn around, as the economy picks up, and as we've learned from history, they will. These problems go away. They tend to solve themselves. And you look at this and you go, okay, well, what has the Obama administration done? The Republicans are saying, we need smaller government. We need to cut spending. We need cut, and punish. We need austerity. Well, Obama has been quite obliging in that world. In fact, government spending under Obama has grown at the slowest pace since Eisenhower. In fact, we're cutting government jobs at an alarming rate and have been for a couple of years. How much more to the bone? And I go back to what Scarnetti said in the clip I played earlier in the show of him saying, oh, we're down into the bone. We went through the fat, the muscle. We're into the bone. There's nowhere else to go. I would argue we've been into the bone. We're causing pain to people every day now because of the cuts and the handoffs that we've given to big business. And I keep asking the question, how much is enough? How much tithing do we have to do to the corporate overloads? How much? I don't know. It's angering, it's frustrating, but you know what? They think we're stupid. And they think we're going to buy it every time. Hope we're not. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Alan Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. Right back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details.
Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com.
An interesting story from the York, Pennsylvania Daily Record. Who pointed out that this guy passed away, 88-year-old World War II vet, Purple Heart recipient, father, grandfather, husband, you know, the whole nine yards, also burger enthusiast. When he died, they took the whole funeral procession right through the drive-thru. Everyone got fast food from Burger King. And when they put him underground, sent a bag with him. I think we've gone a bit too far with the fast food stuff. Just a thought. Anyway, let's find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. I've got Alan Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Alan, thanks for taking time for me.
I went to a funeral of a friend, and this was many years ago, 95, and he wanted everybody, he was dying of AIDS, and he wanted everybody to wear those fake glasses with the fake nose.
Yeah.
And then play Roll Out the Barrel, and that's what we did.
There you go. Yeah. I told my wife, don't do the whole funeral thing. I don't want people to show up to make sure.
Huh?
You know, that save the money. You're going to need it. That's the other message.
Well, I hope you have insurance.
Yeah, I got plenty of insurance, but you know, it's just a huge waste to me. You know, I go back to when, you know, my mother passed away when I was a young kid, and I grew up in a housing project. She never knew luxury, but yet the casket they buried her in laced in satin. And you go, explain to me why now? Never made any sense to me, that whole.
I don't either. I, you know, it's funny. Just one last thing. My mother said she came in the world with nothing and wanted nothing, so she wanted like an Orthodox plain box. And I, my brothers and I looked at each other and we just couldn't do it. So yeah. We went a little bit up, not much, but a little up.
Well, then you've got some answering to do down the road.
I know.
As I told my wife, I said, if you can find a place who will take me by the pound, even though I'm a lot less than I was then, do that, because, again, you're going to need the money. So let's find out. Senator Kerry, now what? Head guy?
He is now going to run the State Department, and he's running the State Department. And the other thing that Senator Kerry will be doing is, of course, traveling around the world. The question is whether he's going to be like the most traveled person, which is, of course, Senator Clinton.
Right. Three votes against him.
I think that Jim Baker, who the two best administrators from everybody's talk in the State Department are former administrator, former Secretary of State James Baker under Bush 1, and also Hillary Clinton. And those are the two, and I guess those are the two the most traveled.
Yeah, I mean, it says a lot. I mean, you go and you talk to people face-to-face, don't use a lot of cables and don't, you know, do a lot of backdoor channel stuff. You know, I guess you'll build relationships, right?
That's for sure.
And you know, as I saw the vote, I was surprised. I'm going, wow, only three people voted against him.
Only three people voted against it. Senator Kerry voted present, and the two Texas senators plus Inhofe voted against it. I mean, I just think this new Texas senator he's a wackadoodle-doo. There's
well,
no question.
Aren't most of the people who swept in under the Tea Party moniker, aren't most of them you know, off the rocker a little bit?
I think so, but that's just my personal opinion.
there's got to be someone doing some studies on this because you know, these are folks that generally they're the anti-government people, but they got elected to run government, which always blows my mind.
Well, yes, but they have a constituency that somehow thinks they're being taxed too much, even though taxes are at the lowest point, you know, in years. And they are just, you know, they're unhappy campers.
Yeah. So is it possible that Cruz could be the face of the Republican Party for the next? Because I seem to think that it's going to be Chris Christie. I think, you know, he's positioning himself kind of in the middle, but, you know, still.
If they want to win an election, it is going to be Chris Christie. If they want to lose an election, it's going to be somebody like our friend in Texas.
Or somebody like Rubio.
Or Rubio.
Yeah. So I'm kind of hoping that Cruz and Rubio and that and the Rand Pauls, I'm hoping that's the new face of the Republican Party so that the mass of people wake up and go, wow, crazy, and go somewhere else.
Well, you know, the Democratic Party had to sort of reform itself after the 60s, 70s, and Republican Party is too. The problem is they're not going to get the evangelicals and their constituency if they do that. Well, do they really need them? If they become Eisenhower, Rockefeller-type Republicans, will they maybe win elections? They might.
Yeah, I mean, and I see this whole immigration thing as the Republicans waking up to the fact that they can't be the Barlottas of the world. They can't be the anti-immigrant people. And there's a lot of questions with this.
When Hispanics get 71% of the vote, that's a little bit of a wake-up call.
Yeah, I mean, but I got to be honest. You know, I'm looking at this immigration plan, and I don't know that I'm all that thrilled with it.
Oh, a lot of us are not that thrilled with it. There have been some real criticisms about it. One, migrant workers. Two, if you need a green card, you have to speak English. Well, you know what? There are a lot of people who are very talented who would like to work here, and they may be medical specialists who do research. They may be computer people. Maybe they don't speak English so well. Why do you need English to get a green card? If you want to say citizenship, which is what they're saying, that's one thing, but not necessarily for that.
Yeah, I mean, and we've been doing that for years. We've been doing the brain drain thing from everywhere else, taking the best and brightest for years. And I don't know that it's all that difficult to get in, is it? Because I've met a lot of people who have gone the high-skilled people, not the people who are going to be working in the factories and in the fields. But I've met a lot of high-skilled people who've come here from other countries. And the tale they tell, not all that difficult.
No, but the issue is also that they want. I mean, some of the immigrant groups are saying we need an end to deportations until some of this gets straightened out.
Yeah. And, you know, I got to be honest, you look at Obama, he has not been the great savior. I mean, how many deportations have we seen in his time in the White House? The number was I forget what Brett told me was, but it was just staggering.
Oh, it varied. Higher than Bush.
And how Bush, expensive is
it? You know, I think I've said this to you on the air before, but I'll tell it to you again. Tony Snow, who was the Bush press secretary, was a good friend of mine. And when Tony, before Tony died, he was sick. And I said to him, Tony, he was press secretary, and I said to him, Tony, why are you still here? Why aren't you, like, taking the time, be with your family, whatever, whatever? And it was very clear he wasn't going to make it. And he said, Ellen, I'm here because I believe in President Bush's immigration plan, and I want to see that happen. Now, Bush was quite a liberal on immigration issues. And it's very interesting that that's what Tony considered his mission to be.
So it wasn't the Bush policy to be chipping guest workers? Because if I remember that being a big, something that really stuck out to me, that the idea of bringing these folks in and then chipping them at the border so we could control them and find where they're, that wasn't part of his official policy?
It may have been. I wasn't aware that that was policy. But, you know, a lot of this was done under the cover of darkness.
Because I fear that's where we're going. I mean,
But he was definitely more liberal than Obama is on this stuff.
Yeah, I don't disagree on that vein. But at the end of the day, what they're putting in front of me, I'm not so thrilled with, because we are creating a couple of tier labor pool, and that is not good for anybody.
No. And that's what a lot of the groups are saying. If you're going to have labor standards, have them be fair labor standards. Don't have like the prison labor that tries to undercut the unions and everybody else. That's not fair.
No. And I fear that's what this visa program is going to do. And, you know, we saw the J-1 visa program here in our neck of the woods up close and firsthand, where they're bringing students from across the world for a cultural exchange to get an experience, a true experience of American life. And they basically put them in a warehouse, you know, working 40, 50 hours a week, living in, you know, in slum conditions.
And then groups like us that are actually trying to get a J-1 visa license so that we can bring real students in and make real money out of them and then send them home, can't get a J-1 visa.
Oh, this was Hershey. I mean, do you have the power and influence of the Hershey Corporation?
No, we have a little talk radio news service. You've been there.
Yeah.
And they say, well, we've taken, you know, students from all over the world. Oh, well, you've never filled out J-1 paperwork. So unless you fill out J-1 paperwork, you can't get the J-1 visas, and it's a catch-22, but they're going to grant it, as you're right, to Hershey or one of those companies.
Yeah, I mean, the abuses that we found as we delved into that whole cesspool just would make your stomach turn. And some of the stories of the people, the kids we talked to who were coming here, because they really wanted the experience, and they spent thousands of dollars of money that they didn't have to come and, you know, basically work in a sweatshop.
Exactly. And then real organizations like us that are really trying to teach them something, particularly Chinese, about democracy and what that entails, we get nowhere.
See, but as I said, they did learn the true cultural experience of the U.S. You come, you bust your behind for virtually no money, and you're underappreciated and exploited. That is the American experience right now.
Unfortunately.
Especially for low-wage workers. And talking about big lobbying money, I saw the NFL spending a bit of money on lobbying.
Yes, and it's unclear what they're spending it for. Part of it may be stadium, you know, kind of money. Part of it may be the head injury issue. They don't want the government to come in and regulate that. I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah,
they're spending five times as much as they did 10 years ago.
Well, I mean, they've got a lot more things on the in the public eye, especially here recently with the president saying that if he had a son, you know, he would, you know, have to consider it. I've had this conversation with my wife. I played football, you know, from the time I was a kid all the way through high school. In fact, I got to be honest, the only reason I ever finished high school was because I played football. At a time that was a time where, you know, education, going to school, not a big thing for me.
But I look at this and I go, with my son, yeah, I'm a little leery myself because, you know, I got those injuries and the concussions and all of that.
Right. And that's a big concern. And I think that's what a lot of their lobbying is, because they don't want to cut off their high school golden goose.
Yeah, good point. Senator Blumenthal calling for background checks?
Yes, he is, but not background checks for guns, but if you want to buy ammunition. He said, you know, right now you have a background check for a gun, maybe, but you have nothing for ammunition. And why should people be allowed to buy all this ammunition without a background check?
See, because the Second Amendment says nothing about ammunition. It says you have the right to a gun.
Right.
If you only read half the sentence.
Exactly. A well-regulated militia doesn't figure in.
No, our attention span is shortening, and eventually it'll just be guns. It'll just be arms. That's all. But, you know, I look at this, and I remember the Chris Rock bit, you know, a couple of years back where he said, you know, make bullets like $5,000, so each one would be precious, and if you wanted to kill somebody, you really have to hate that guy. And finally, something I've been talking about, the Treasury Secretary, the Treasury Department came out and figured out that they've been paying, well, the TARP people a little bit too much money.
Yes. I mean, the data on that is just staggering, and the name of the report sounds like something that comes out of a think tank. But no, it actually came out of TARP. It's called The Treasury Continues Approving Excessive Pay for Top Executives That Bailed Out Companies. And they found that in 2012, they approved pay packages. This is money that USA government loaned people, $3 million for more than 54% of the 69 top 25 employees at American International Group, that's AIG, General Motors, another bailout, the Acceptance Corporation, and then there were even more approved for a couple other corporations, top executives. I mean, that's just crazy.
Is it any surprise, though? I mean, come on. You're talking about the Treasury Department is full of Wall Street types. Is it any surprise that they believe, well, you know, especially with the swinging door back and forth, is it any surprise that, oh, we need these people, these really smart people who know what they're doing, you know, the exact ones who crashed the economy? We need them to save us.
It's crazy.
It is crazy.
And when I saw that report, honestly, I could not believe my eyes.
What's surprising to me is that the report ever saw the light of day.
It is. And you know something? It hasn't really seen the light of day in the press.
Understand who owns the press.
I own part of the press. I mean, of course, we're not major league.
Right. Well, you know, hey, did the Wall Street Journal and all the rest of them do it? Because that's usually where people pick stuff up.
Right.
Yeah, it is what it is.
No, they
didn't. And it's not surprising.
It didn't show up.
And it is not surprising.
It's quite shocking, but not surprising.
Yeah, well, we got to take care of the well-heeled, because they're the job creators. Remember that, Ellen. Without them, we would just be standing around starving.
Ha.
That's what we're told. Ellen Ratner, I appreciate the talk. I look forward to seeing you Thursday and Friday.
I am going to see you. I'm excited.
At the Families USA Healthcare Conference there in Washington, D.C. Look forward to it. Thanks so much, Ellen.
You got it.
Quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
When does the age of Aquarius begin? And what is the age of Aquarius?
The age of Aquarius isn't part of astronomy. It's an astrological age, which occurs because of a real motion of Earth known as the precession of the equinoxes. The cycle of precession lasts 25,800 years. There are 12 constellations in the zodiac.
So roughly every 2,150 years, the sun's position at the time of the March equinox moves in front of a new zodiac constellation. The age of Aquarius is said to begin when the equinox point moves out of Pisces and into station Aquarius.
But there's no definitive answer as to when that will be. From an astronomical point of view, the International Astronomical Union created official constellation boundaries as recently as 1930. Based on those boundaries, the March equinox will cross over into the constellation Aquarius in the year 2597.
Meanwhile, Nicholas Campion at the University of Wales has studied astrologers' ideas about when we enter the age of Aquarius. They range from the year 1447 AD to the year 3597 AD. So, even among astrologers, there's no consensus as to when the age of Aquarius begins.
For more, search on Aquarius at earthsky.org. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Mike Brennan. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith. We don't pick up the ball, the more we do it's full of precious beneath us. Don't put the lock, but then we'll pay for it.
Yes, you're a pirate. Yes,
It's one of Brett's favorite songs there. Very, very good for him. Interesting story. Monday, in Seattle, the police department there had a gun buyback day. So if you had some guns, you want to take it in, they'll give you some money for it, I guess. While not probably the best way of getting guns off the streets, I guess it is one way of getting some, because most of the people, according to reports, most of the people bring in broken guns or because they just needed the money and there was a couple of bucks. But it's what they've done. Interestingly enough, the Seattle buyback day came up with 4 stolen guns that didn't know they were out there out of the 716 that they collected. But interestingly enough, one of the people who was watching this saw someone outside of the buyback purchase a military-grade weapon, one of these surface-to-air missile launchers. You're in the parking lot of the police station where they're buying back guns, and you're going to go, I'm going to go trade in my surface-to-air missile launcher. Another citizen saw it. Somebody come by and say, hey, I'll buy that for me. I'll give you $100 for it, probably more than they'll give you inside, and I guess sold it. Now the police, got involved, and now they're trying to figure out if this was something that was stolen from the military, how it was gotten, what's the history of it. Interestingly enough, I guess it was last month, Los Angeles had their buyback. They unearthed 2 anti-tank rocket launchers. So, this argument that, we leave things the way they are and just enforce the gun laws we have, there's a huge problem because how does someone get a hold of a rocket launcher? And I know the NRA would say we should have the right to a rocket launcher, right? Because they're the ones who say we should have an immediate blanket of armed school security guards out there to, big blanket of security around our children, according to the NRA. These from the people who, in the last week, there have been 6 shootings at gun shows. Think about it. See you back here tomorrow.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, infamous.